is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
This Week in Radical History for the week starting October 6th. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer. Radical info can be found at the Daily Bleed website. And some audio was borrowed from the Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York. This Week in Radical History for October 7th.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died to see. I never died to see.
In 1879, labor organizer Joe Hill is born. He'd be killed on this date by the state of Utah after a sham trial. He wired his labor organizers' friends these words: I'd like to die a true blue rebel. Don't waste any more time mourning. Organize. And his last words in front of the firing squad was, fire.
San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where working men defend their rights, it's there you'll find Joe Hill. It's there you'll find Joe Hill.
And it is right here where you will find more radical history. Like on October 7th in 1909, letting all principals know what's up, the U.S. Consulate reports a revolution against the Nicaraguan government will begin on October 8th. Also on this date in 1934 in Brazil, green shirt fascists in Sao Paulo attempt to mimic Mussolini's march on Rome, only to be scattered in disarray when confronted by the anarchists and farm workers, who unite in opposition to the fascists. Also on this date in 1969, the Haymarket statue, a memorial to cops slain who fired on workers in 1886 in Chicago, is bombed, reported to be bombed by the Weather Underground. The mayor rebuilds the statue, and it is bombed again next year. Learning his lesson, the mayor rebuilds it again and has to place a 24-hour guard around the statue. Also on this date in 1969, black football players at the University of Wyoming are kicked off the team for protesting against the Mormons of Utah State for segregation at Brigham Young University. Also on October 7, 1987, religious zealous and hypocrite Pat Robinson acknowledges to the Wall Street Journal report that he's been less than candid about his wedding date and his first child was born only 10 weeks after his marriage. He follows a long line before him and after him, like Family Values man Ronald Reagan, who married his second wife Nancy, who had a baby 7 months after that, and hypocrite VP candidate Palin shotgun weddings. In your face, Christian Family Values. Two more items for October 7th, 1990. Justice Department reports U.S. prison population doubled in the last 10 years. Worst in the Western world. Yeah, we're number one. We're number one. Lastly, in 1993, Guatemala, a mass grave of 150 women and children murdered by the U.S.-supported and trained Guatemala army is opened. The U.S. government documents released in 1999 describes in chilling detail, often in cold bureaucratic language, how American advisors and their Cold War obsession spurred on the killing and hid the horrible secrets from the public. This Week in Radical History for October 8th, only got a couple items. 1871, Mrs. O'Leary's cow starts a Chicago fire in the evening, kills over 200 and over 98,000 left homeless as 3.5 square miles of the city burn to the ground. As Chicago blazes away some 200 miles to the south, an even deadlier fire rips through Peshtigo, Wisconsin, completely razing to the town and killing 600 of its inhabitants. Over a million acres of forest was also consumed. Also for October 8, 1976, President Ford signs a bill to terminate Indian Claims Commission, ending any mechanism for repayment of land stolen from the tribes. In the year 2000, over 1,000 protesters gather to oppose Hong Kong's law prohibiting public demonstration by more than 30 people without permission of Officer Friendly. You know, why not do what freedom-loving, protecting United States does and give protesters free speech zones, nice pinned-in areas to express themselves? Also in the year 2000, that date, hey Saddam, beat this. American government releases documents showing it tested chemical and biological weapons in the open air in Alaska, Hawaii, Alberta, Canada, and Great Britain. We're number one. We're number one. This Week in Radical History for October 9th, breaking the myth once again that America was founded on religious freedoms. In 1635, Roger Williams, a member of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, an outspoken critic of the ill treatment of Native Americans, is banished from the colonies for, quote, religious heresy, unquote.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, October 9th in 1823, Black American abolitionist and newspaper publisher Mary Ann Shad Carey was born in Wilmington, Delaware. When Mary was 17 years old, she opened a school for black children in Pennsylvania. 10 years later, the Fugitive Slave Act was passed and Mary moved to Canada, where she founded a racially integrated school, as well as establishing the Provincial Freeman, a newspaper that attacked slavery and promoted the education of blacks. After moving back to the U.S., Mary graduated from Howard Law School, becoming the second black woman in the U.S. to graduate with a law degree. During her career as a lawyer, Mary Ann Shad worked hard to achieve voting rights for women in America. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Also on this date in 1936, during a lettuce strike in Salinas, California, red flags appeared around town, specifically at intersections and power poles. Fearing communists, the local authorities took down the flags, only discovered later that they were part of a traffic check being made by the State Highway Division. Oops. Also on this date in 1969, 2,500 National Guard called into Chicago, Illinois, for the 9th through the 11th during the Weather Underground Days of Rage protest. For a great movie on the Weather Underground, to see a pretty reasonable evolution and delusion of political uprising in this country, see the Academy Award-nominated movie from 2 years ago, also called Weather Underground. Also on October 9, 1970 in England, the Italian Trade Center, Exhibition Building, Cork Street, London is bombed. Attacks simultaneously happen in Manchester, Birmingham, Paris, and against Italian state buildings. The attacks were claimed on behalf of an Italian anarchist murdered by the police in 1969, part of a large series of bombings for this year, believed to be attributed to the Anarchist Angry Brigade. Two more items are October 9, 1983. James Watts resigns as Reagan's Secretary of the Interior, after referring to his appointment of a black, a woman, two Jews, and a cripple. Early in this week, one of Reagan's aides also pleads guilty to the involvement in the weapons for hostage trade Iran-Contra scandal.
We talk without words, and everybody understands. Just desserts, delivered by hand. Nobody move, or the CEO hits it in the face with cream and dough.
See the scramble to the top.
Lastly, for October 9th, 1998, neoliberal economist Milton Friedman gets just desserts at the Marriott Hotel in San Francisco during the School Choice and Corporate America Conference. The Triple B field agents, custard and lemon meringue, approached him and let fly with tofu cream and sweet potato pies. Just desserts, delivered by hand. This week in Radical History for October 10th, 1609 in England. Gerard Winstanley, founder of the Diggers, is born. The Diggers attempted to reform by leveling real property, the existing social order of the time, with an agrarian lifestyle based upon their ideas of the creation of a small, egalitarian rural communities. Their use of public lands in England enraged the local manor owners and townspeople, and the government would eventually put them all down. Here's a song about the Diggers written by Winstanley at the time, sung by the anarchist group Chumbawamba.
Stand up now, you noble diggers, all stand up now. The wasteland to maintain, seen cavaliers by name, your digging does maintain, and persons all defame. Stand up now. With spades and hoes and ploughs, stand up now, with spades and hoes and ploughs, stand up now. Your freedom to uphold, seeing cavaliers are bold, to kill you if they could, and rights from you to hold, stand up now, diggers all. The lawyers they conjoin, stand up now, the lawyers they conjoin, stand up now. To arrest you they advise, such fury they devise, the devil in them lies, and have blinded both their eyes, stand up now,
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham, and we continue it in his memory. This is John Roberts. This week we feature a conversation with Israeli journalist Gideon Levy, who writes for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. Levy met with a visiting delegation from the United States in Israel, sponsored by the Tree of Life Foundation. Gideon Levy pulls no punches when he speaks and writes. We were fortunate to receive this conversation from a member of the delegation who recorded it exclusively for This Week in Palestine. Here is Israeli journalist Gideon Levy.
My name is Gideon Levy. I'm a columnist for Haaretz, and I'm very, very happy to be here. And I'm following the Tree of Life from distance, and I think you are doing a great job. And I think for people like me, you are the hope. And I'll try to explain why. Because one should understand that the occupation will not come to its end as long as the present situation will continue. For Israel to put an end to the occupation doesn't pay. There's no reason for Israel to put an end to the occupation. No incentive, no motivation, nothing. The status quo is by far better for Israel, in Israeli eyes, than any change in the status quo. The world is just supporting the status quo, except of some lip services. The world is supporting the occupation actively or passively. And the fact is that no one in the world is doing anything serious about putting an end to the occupation. The Palestinians are as weak and as divided as never before. Lacking leadership, lacking energy, lacking being united. And I think, in my view, they are in their worst situation ever since the 60s. And when this is the situation, one shouldn't expect any change, because there is no reason for change. And the idea is to change this situation, in which for Israel the occupation is a better alternative than putting an end to the occupation. That's the only way to bring an end to it, by changing this equilibrium, by making Israel lose, pay, being punished for the occupation. Only by this there will be a motivation to put an end to it. Otherwise, it will not happen. This change cannot and will not come from within Israel. I said it 2 years ago when we were together, and I can say it much more now. Because anything which was true 2 years ago is now worse. We are going only to the opposite direction. But without getting into too many, to a resolution of Israeli politics, by the end of the day, for an average Israeli, there is no reason to put an end to the occupation. He is not interested in the occupation. He knows very little about the occupation. He had never been there. His life is wonderful. Why to bother? I mean, he doesn't want to hear about it. And the change cannot come in this situation from within the Israeli society. Cannot come, will not come. Because the Israeli society, as I said, have nothing to lose by continuing the occupation, and have a lot to lose if we put an end to the occupation. Let's be frank. We don't know what will be. Any change can lead to, you know, various directions. And for an Israeli whose life is quite good, why would he go for a change? Why? Especially when brainwash system in this country is so efficient, when so many Israelis are so confident that the IDF is the most moral army in the world, that we are the only victims in the area, that the Palestinians want only one thing, and this is how to exterminate the Jews. Every Palestinian wakes up in the morning with only one thought in his mind: how will he kill as many Jews as possible today? When all those are the main values, and add to this the fact that most of the Israelis, and I was talking about it also when I was there in Connecticut, that most of the Israelis also deeply believe that we are the chosen people, that we have special rights, that we deserve more, that we are the biggest victim in history, and because we are the biggest victims in history, we deserve anything almost, and nobody can tell us what to do. And international law doesn't apply for us, because international law applies for any country, but not for us, because we are a special case. So if you add all this together, we are getting to the quite depressing conclusion that we can't expect a change in the coming future, for sure not from within the Israeli society. And here comes the role of the international community. Because the Israeli society is so much in denial, because the Israeli society has so little interest and motivation, it is on the shoulders of the international community. Now, when it comes to governments, again, why would they bother? And again, we have to admit that if there will be not pressure from within civil societies on the governments, governments will not go very far. I think that the EU, the United States, and many other countries have so many other issues right now. The Palestinians are really one of their last priorities. Who cares? Not only this, we have the Islamophobia, we have the xenophobia, we have the terror, we have Syria, and for most of the Westerns, you know, all the Arabs are the same, all the Muslims are the same. No way that the Palestinians will be perceived as something else. They are one of those Arabs who are a danger, and it's also not in the interest of the EU, for example, to do something extraordinary to put an end to the occupation. Why would they? They really face bigger problems. Not to speak about the United States, not to speak about the United States with Donald Trump, because when I was over there, we still had a president whose heart was at least in the right place. He did nothing, but at least we knew that his heart was in the right place. Nobody expects Donald Trump to stand for justice, for minorities, for Arabs, for Muslims, for any kind of values. I mean, I don't have to say it here. Zero expectations, obviously. And this leaves us really with this situation, which the only name, the only game in town is the civil societies, are the civil societies. That's right now the only player who can really make a change. And when I say civil societies, I mean Tree of Life, I mean you, I mean similar groups, both in Europe and in the United States. In Europe it's much easier in certain countries, because there is more awareness and more knowledge than in the United States. I mean, you know it better than me, but most of the Americans are, unfortunately, quite ignorant about what's going on here, and whatever they know is so false that many times I say I'd rather have them without any knowledge rather than the knowledge that they have.
Yeah,
I mean, it's better not to know where is Israel and what is Israel and who are the Palestinians rather than to know what they know. Because how many of them are reading New York Times or Haaretz? Very, very few, as we know. So in the United States and in Europe, the situation is a little better in terms of knowledge. I mean, bigger parts of society, not everyone, obviously, but bigger parts of society are more involved, are more concerned, are more knowledgeable. But by the end of the day, the key is, first of all, in the United States. And here I say what I've said again. I'm sorry to repeat myself, Mary, but the day that the United States will wish that the occupation will come to its end, it will end within months. Within months. The United States, let's be frank, never wanted to put an end to the occupation. There was not a single American president, including Barack Obama, who really wanted to put an end to the occupation. How do I know it? Because they did nothing, and they could have done so much more. Peace plans, I mean, the first peace plan was in 1970 by Rogers, the Secretary of State Rogers, before most of you were born. And ever since then, the peace plans repeat themselves. It's always the same ideas. It gets to the same again and again. Tens and tens of peace plans which say always the same, and then they get into the jury and are totally forgotten, and nobody really means to do something about it. Many administrations and governments in Europe, I must say, always believe that with Israel the only way is to go with carrots and to offer Israel the moon. But it didn't work. It never worked. And it will never work. Europe didn't understand it yet, and the United States didn't understand it yet. Or maybe they both don't want to understand it. But it will not go with carrots. No way. Now, American administrations paid the lip service, did nothing. But they did more than this. They not only did nothing. They are the financiers of the occupation, they supply the weapons for the occupation, they supply the political support in the international organizations for this, for the occupation. Let's remember it. It's not just that the American administration, all the American administration were passive. No. They were very active pro-occupation. Veto after veto in the Security Council, arms deals, I don't have to tell you, and economical support like no other country in the world. No other country in the world. You know, big Russia conquered some part of Crimea, of how you call it in English? We call it Crimea. The place where Russia innovated.
Crimea,
yeah. We call it Crimea. And within weeks, the EU put sanctions on Russia. On Russia. The big Russia. Within weeks. And here we face an occupation of 50 years. When sanctions are, it's even not legitimate to mention the word, obviously. But not only sanctions, no pressure. Only support. And this brings you to the conclusion that Europe and the United States actively want the continuance of the occupation, because otherwise they wouldn't react like this. And even by the lip service condemning the settlement, they play a positive role for the occupation. Because this lip service, which Israel totally ignores, enable Israel to go wild, because they know they will play their role, we will play our role. The State Department will condemn Israel, And Israel learned by now that it can totally ignore those condemnations. They have no meaning whatsoever. Now they are even not condemnations. Yeah, with your adorable ambassador to the UN, which, you know, it would be embarrassing for me if she would have been ambassador of Israel. I mean, she's much more pro-Israel than the right-wingers in Israel. I never saw such a thing. Really, that's a phenomena. She is a phenomena, I must tell you. Lies that she's spreading, this woman, and the way she supports Israel, it's really by far more than the right-wingers would dream about in Israel, yeah? This woman, I wrote about her once already, this woman is really embarrassing. But she's the voice of America, let's face it. She walks with the heels in order to kick all the critics of Israel. Ambassador of the United States. Embarrassing. But in any case, again and again, when we look at the relations between the United States and Israel, as I said in Connecticut, one should ask, who is the superpower between the two? And who is dictating whom in this game? Because really, if you look at it in an objective way, you really can get the impression that Israel is the superpower and the United States is following Israel. And now we face the new phase, which is the big struggle against BDS, which is a new actor, which Israel found as after Iran, that's the biggest enemy of Israel. And look how the West is reacting to BDS. This is really an unbelievable phase. They are all over Europe and the United States, this criminalization of BDS. I mean, it's unbelievable in democracies that a civil rights organization, non-violent, democratic, is fighting for a cause. You can agree with this cause, you can disagree, and they criminalize it as if boycott is something criminal. Israel is calling the whole world to boycott Hamas, to boycott Iran. The Israelis are boycotting Turkey because Turkey was not very friendly, so we don't go to Turkey anymore, we went less to vacation in Turkey, and those boycotts are legitimate. People don't want to buy meat, and they boycott shops which sell meat. People want to boycott the labor in East Asia, yeah, the sweat, how you call it? Sweatshops. This is legitimate. People don't want to buy stolen goods. And I boycott. I know that this is stolen good. I don't buy it. But boycotting products from Israel or from the occupied territories, this is criminal. Not less than criminal. In many states already in your country, there are already legislations. You know, that's for you to ask, how is it possible, for God's sake, in a democracy, how can it be that a non-violent step, okay, you can be against it, no problem, but to make it illegal, to call for boycotting and criminal occupation that not one single country in the world supports. Not one single country in the world supports 1 meter of the occupation. So to call to boycott an occupation which, again I say, the entire international community declares as illegal. The entire international community. Not 1 meter, including not Jerusalem. No country in the world. There is no consensus like the international consensus like the consensus about the occupation. Russia and Europe and Asia and Africa and the United States and the Arab world, and everyone is not recognizing the occupation, perceiving it as illegal. and then to boycott this illegal occupation becomes criminal? And it goes like a fire from state to state, including Europe, including liberal Europe. I was in Germany a few weeks ago in a tour, and they almost in few cities put a condition for my talk, when it was in a public venue, that I will not support BDS in my speech. Yeah. And I didn't agree. And obviously in this country it becomes also illegal. But in Israel it's a different case. Not that I support it, but when the West is criminalizing BDS, I can't complain about Israel, which makes it criminal. And we will struggle here, and even if it will become illegal, I will continue to support it, because BDS is right now the only game in town. That's the only way. If you remember my first part of my talk, when I say that we have to change this balance in which Israel does not pay for the occupation, BDS is the mean to make Israel pay for the occupation, to really shake this situation in which Israel has no incentive to put an end to the occupation. I'm not a BDS activist. I'm not an activist at all, and for me, it took many years until I supported BDS, because it's not very simple to be an Israeli who does not boycott Israel, because I live here. I buy Israeli products. I pay Israeli tax. It's very complicated to come and say you boycott what I don't. If you boycott Israel, go away. Why do you live here? So it's not very simple for me to call others to boycott. And I really don't call others, but I must admit, or I must say, that right now that's the only game. Because that's the only way, non-violent way, to make Israel gradually start to pay for the occupation. To make Israelis being punished. And being punished means that then they will start to think about it. Because until they will be punished, until they will pay, nobody will care about the occupation. No way. So this is also a phase which is not very promising, because what the Western governments are doing against BDS. And again, the ball is in your court, in your yard, because you and others are the only one who can make now a change. That's the truth. Change will come only from civil societies, who will push governments, hopefully your own government, and that's the only way to go for a change. Last word, because I want to leave time for questions. Last word about the two state, one state, and again I repeat myself for those who heard me already, but it must be said. I was a great supporter of the two state solution. The two state solution is the most logical solution. Two peoples share one state, let's divide it. That's the simple way and the most logical way. I think that the two state solution is not viable anymore. I think we missed the chance. I think Israel and the settlers have done everything possible to make this solution impossible, and they succeeded. And we have to face it. You know, to continue to speak about two-state solution when deep in our hearts we know it will never happen, it's again falling into a trap that Israel is putting. Israel wants everyone to speak about two-state. Even Netanyahu spoke about two-states. Why not? Let's speak about two-state. With no intention whatsoever to enable it ever. And how do we know that Israel never meant it? Because Israel never stopped building the settlements. And anybody who builds one house in the occupied territories have no intention to evacuate the West Bank ever. Because you don't build in a place where you have any intention to evacuate. And you know, Israel never stopped under any government. So as long as Israel does not stop building settlements, we know that Israel does not want the two-state solution. Very simple. As simple as this. That's the only indication. If you build in the West Bank, you mean to stay in the West Bank. Very simple. And if this is the case, and we got already so many settlers, which I don't believe any Israeli will be ever able to evacuate, we have to it's very hard to admit, but we have to admit that they won and we lost. And we have to start to think what is the alternative. And not to be stuck, you know, in yesterday's solution, because it will never happen. It's a train that left already the station and will never be back. And again, if someone will convince me that the two-state solution is still viable, I'll be more than happy. But I don't see it happening. And therefore, the discourse must change. It's a long way to go. But we have to start to talk about equal rights. We have to start to talk about one man or one person, one vote. We have to start to talk about the one-state solution. Now, for Israelis, this is last Friday. This time, I had another lecture with well-off Israelis. They meet, they have a parliament in a very luxurious restaurant every Friday. You know, the mainstream of the mainstream. I was the youngest, by the way, which is very rare. And I spoke with them about the one-state solution, and I saw that they can't swallow their food. I mean, they regretted so much inviting me. This was far beyond what they could not only digest, could hear. Yeah, because this means that Zionism must come to its end. And this will be very, 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 very hard for almost every Israeli. The idea of a Jewish state will have to come to its end. No Israeli, I mean, I can hardly think about 10 Israelis who would support it right now. I mean 10, not 10,000 and not 10 million. 10 Israelis. I don't think there are more than 10 Israelis living in Israel who are supporting right now. Which doesn't seem very promising and doesn't seem as a clear majority. It's a very, very long way to go. We have to start it because we have no other choice. We have to start to talk about it. I start to talk about it, but I know it's a very long way, but that's the only open way. We have just to tell everybody, including in your country, that a one-state solution is not such a revolution. We are living for 50 years now in a one-state. It's not such a revolution. The only problem is that this state is not a democracy. That's the only problem. It is a democracy for Jewish citizens, but it's not a democracy in the occupied territory. So the only thing is to make it a democracy. The one state is here, and the binational state is here, because we are already between the river and the sea. We are 50% Palestinians and 50% Jews, and nobody can change it. And Gaza is part of it. They always say, no, but without Gaza. What do you mean without Gaza? What will Gaza, where will Gaza go again? To the ocean? Without Gaza, because Gaza is another 2.5 million people, yeah? No, Gaza is part of the Palestinian people. So by the end of the day, for the very long run, I think this should be the discourse. It is hard to sell it right now, to market it in your country. It is impossible to market in this country. When I start to speak about it, people really think that I should go to a therapist. That's the usual reaction. But when you come and tell them, what do you suggest? No, a Jewish state, two-state solution. I say, yeah, but where have you been? If you wanted the Jewish state, where have you been in the last 50 years? You did anything possible to destroy it. So how can you speak now about the Jewish state? You can't eat the cake and have it. It's either or. You want a Jewish state, you can't have the occupied territories. You want the occupied territories, you can't have a Jewish state. It is so simple. And by the end of the day, obviously, it is also the most just solution. Because if we go for equal rights, then we don't have the problem of the 2 million Palestinians who live in Israel, who are citizens of Israel, 2 million, 20% of the citizens of Israel, who is a question by itself. We can solve the problem of return, the right of return, because if it's an equal democracy, then there are equal rights, and then immigration to the state will be on an equal basis, Jews and Palestinians. There must be a policy. No country opens its gates, you know, in an unlimited way. There will be a policy in which Palestinians and Jews will be able to immigrate to this country. But for this, you need first to change the regime. So it's a very, very long way to go. And I have no illusions. And right now, everything looks really, really hopeless. But as I always say, many, many things in history happened without anybody expecting it. I always mention the collapse of Soviet Russia. Nobody had foreseen it. The collapse of the apartheid regime in South Africa, nobody had foreseen it. The fall of the Berlin Wall, nobody had foreseen it. And even not the Arab Spring, nobody, no expert saw it coming. And nobody knows now where are we going to, because as Shimon Peres always say, all the experts are experts for what had happened already. No expert is for what's going to happen. So thank you very much, and I'll be happy to take your questions, remarks, whatever. I'm at your service.
Now I'm really depressed.
I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry, but at least it was... I hope the others gave you more hope. I'm sure that Jeff... you met Jeff Halper, yeah, you said? I'm sure Jeff Halper is more optimistic than me. He is, by character, much more optimistic. So I'm sure he was more hopeful than me, but I'll be happy to be convinced that I'm wrong. I'll be very, very happy to hear that I'm totally wrong and the solution is around the corner.
Jeff said that 85% of the land that the Palestinians were chased off of is still open. Is that true, in your opinion?
Jeff is much better than me in figures. Mm-hmm. And if Jeff said so, absolutely. Yeah.
The problem, I was surprised to hear that.
Yeah.
I was
so embarrassed. The problem is with the figure of settlers. Because together with Jerusalem, we are almost 700,000 settlers. And that's a figure. It's 450 without Jerusalem, but how can we exclude Jerusalem? There are settlers there as well. I mean, Israel annexed Jerusalem, but it doesn't make it less occupied. So I don't see a solution without evacuating them, and I don't see anyone evacuating 700 settlers, which are the strongest political group in Israeli society, don't forget. Those settlers are the most powerful group in our politics, by far. They are devoted, they are well organized, unlikely the mainstream, who is totally apathetic and indifferent. They are very active, and therefore they are very powerful. In any government.
Good evening. As you know, I frequently open the day by looking online to read Haaretz, and your columns give me hope, although I don't know why they give me hope.
I failed. If it gives you hope, I failed.
But the role of journalism, I think, is a critical one here and at home. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about these people who come from different workplaces.
Right.
What are the dynamics among journalists on this issue? And could you share a little bit about what life is like within the Haaretz office?
Absolutely. About Israeli journalism, they are all labeled as leftists and as the leftist mafia. The truth is that maybe there is a majority of leftist journalists in this country, but Israeli media and Israeli newspapers and Israeli TV are totally supporting the Zionistic narrative, and really, with the only exception of Haaretz, they are all recruited, self-recruited, by the way, with self-censorship, very little pressure from the government. But because of commercial reasons, because everyone wants to sell newspapers or to get rating, they all betray their mission. They all don't tell the truth about the occupation. Israeli average media consumer doesn't get any picture about the occupation and knows very little about it. and whatever he knows is always very biased. Dehumanization, really, and demonization. Every teenager of 14 who goes with a knife to the checkpoint is immediately labeled as a terrorist, and every execution of such a terrorist is obviously the only way to deal with a 14-year-old girl who had a fight with her mother 2 hours before and went to the checkpoint in order to commit suicide, and the soldiers helped her to commit suicide. She will be perceived as an existential threat to Israel, and the execution will be presented as the only way to fight terror, and this happens on a weekly basis. Many periods even on a daily basis. The Israeli media is the biggest collaborator with the occupation, and they do so against maybe their own conscience, and they don't do it out of ideology. They do it because this is the only way to sell, because you don't want to bother your readers, and if you do so, people will leave you. The other day, just to give you the idea of the atmosphere in this country, a teacher in a high school in a very well-off town in the south community, it's even not a town, it's a small community, quite well-off, quite developed, people really from upper middle class. She wrote in her Facebook page that she supports the asylum seekers and their right to live here, which is another issue. And now there is immediately after she wrote really some posts about the right of the African asylum seekers to stay with us, there is immediately a movement of the parents in her school, and she had to leave the school within days because they labeled her as a traitor, as a right winger, as a left winger, which is a curse in Israel. To be a leftist in Israel is a curse, and she had to leave her school. It's just from this week. This happens on a weekly basis, daily basis. It is really McCarthyism, but McCarthyism was in many ways less aggressive than what's happening here, because it goes down to the society. It's not that it comes from the government only. It comes also from the street, from the society itself. In this case of the teacher, even the ministry, the education ministry, supported her, which was quite surprising, because the minister of education is a real extreme right-winger. But he supported her, but the street said it word, and nobody could stop it, and she had to resign. So that's the atmosphere right now in Israel. And that's the atmosphere also in the media. Except of my newspaper, in which, as I told you 2 years ago, I can tell you this also today, that I gained full support, full freedom. And so I'm not only the only one in this newspaper. Not everyone shares my views, but the freedom is total, and until now, no pressure whatsoever. And I can tell you that I go more and more radical. Nobody stops me. Nobody. Really, total freedom. And even not the government or the secret services, nothing. I have no problems until now. I don't take it for granted. Yes, please.
We heard from a young woman who was active with Breaking the Silence, and it seems to me that that certainly should have an effect, or at least to get people, some Jews in Israel and around the world, starting to think about what the occupation means. I mean, that's really brave of these young people to come out and give testimony. Is that having any impact?
When Breaking the Silence was established, we thought that this will be a game changer. Because this is not Gideon Levy, the traitor, the communist, the self-hating Jew, but soldiers who were there, who give testimonies about what they have done in person. But immediately, the establishment, it's a very interesting case. The establishment on one hand, the army, and the media, together, started a very brutal campaign of delegitimizing Breaking the Silence, and they crushed them. And Breaking the Silence today is perceived like BDS, I mean, as an enemy of this country, a really enemy. And they succeeded. No impact whatsoever, because they delegitimized them in a way that it was all gone. And this was a very good example of collaboration between the military establishment and the media, who did it again voluntarily. They didn't do, nobody forced the media to take part in it. And I can tell you that some of the programs who did all kind of terrible investigation about Breaking the Silence, they're all lefties, liberals. But they know what is expected from them. So unfortunately, they had no impact whatsoever. And they are now labeled as the worst enemies. And then you have no influence. Once you are labeled as an enemy, so who will listen to you? As liars. They're all labeled as liars also. Yes, please.
Yeah, Gideon, this week it was reported that Jewish Voice for Peace has started a campaign to encourage young Jewish kids, college students, to sign a petition stating that they would not take a birthright trip to Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious about your reaction to that strategy, both in terms of JVP as an organization, the value of that to JVP as an organization, and also as to how that would affect those kids.
That's by far the right thing to do. I have a relative, a very distant relative, who tried to establish an organization which took kids who came with Taglit,
birthright,
to stay, to extend their stay here for a few more days, and they took them to see the occupation, which was fantastic, but so very few did it. And I think he died, I don't know. He is now in Indonesia for many years, so I don't know if I lost contact. I don't think they didn't succeed much, because finally most of the Jewish kids were very happy with what they get, and very few of them stayed. They got, by the way, for free. You stay another week and we take care of you, and they took them really to see a refugee camp, everything that they didn't see. This was fantastic. If this would be the case, I would say, let's make it happen. Let them go to the Zionistic propaganda. But if they are exposed also to the other side of the moon, that's fair. But this will not happen. I don't know how effective it will be, this step. But birthright is so destructive. They are brainwashing them, really. It's embarrassing. They take them. When I see them always, they take them. They always have those guards with old guns which can't shoot, but just to show them in which terrible danger the Jews are living in this country. They are so scared to get out of their homes, because any corner there might be an Arab who will come and slaughter us. So we have those armed guys who guard us, who save us from the terrible danger. Really annoying.
Did you say that the extend was created? That's a good thing, extend?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was a cover up, and maybe they were going into the West Bank and doing and seeing ridiculous things.
No,
so
there was.
Extend was good.
It was excellent. They took them really to extend was the name. Yeah.
Yes.
They took them to see refugee camps. I followed them once. They went to Ramallah. They went to refugee camps. They showed them the occupation. In very few days, because they had only few days, but at least they opened their eyes. But so very few participated. That's the problem. But it was very good, very very good. Again, if Jewish Voice for Peace will succeed, this will be fantastic. But as we know, we are a minority. Jewish Voice for Peace is a minority, but I think that birthright is very destructive, very, very destructive. And it's also, you know, in terms even of, okay, propaganda, but, you know, if you take teenagers and you sell them so many lies and you hide so many truths, so much truth, and you don't take them to see everything, I don't say take them only to Ramallah, or take them only to a refugee camp. Okay. But when you don't show them anything from this side, and you tell them all those rubbish about the dangers and the victimization, and those are young people, you know, they will carry it forever.
How about our congressional representatives, members of Senate? Have any of them sought out your perspective on things?
Not that I know. Mm-hmm. Not that I know, no.
That's the impasse that we have at home. Yeah. We live in Connecticut with two of the most progressive senators and some excellent representatives on every other issue, but not this one.
That's a question mark. How come? I mean, even human rights activists, when they come to this issue as if this is a different game, I never understood it. How can it be? I mean, really, you talk to intelligent liberals, and when it comes to Israel, all of a sudden. But look, you see also a lot of progress. I understand that in the campuses, things are happening. You know it better than I.
Yeah, Israel.
Israel is very nervous, and the fact that Israel is very nervous about BDS means that BDS. Must be doing something right. Roger Waters, our friend, is now having a tour. He just finished it now, 50 concerts in the United States. And in each concert, he said something about us. He is really so devoted and so it's unbelievable. But he had also problems. He had problems. And he had some venues were closed for him. In the United States, so it's a struggle, but there are some good signs, no doubt. I mean, the young generation of the students, I think, in the United States, there is a bigger and bigger part of the American students who start to understand that something is wrong, and that they are part of it, and the United States is part of it. It's just very, very slow. But it's going to the right direction. This is a source of hope.
What kind of harassment do you get for speaking so openly?
It depends on the atmosphere. Now it's more relaxed, but 2014, when there was the war in Gaza, I had bodyguards, and it was very, very unpleasant. My partner, someone spit at her in the market, someone spit at me, there was some violence. It can be very unpleasant. Right now it's okay. Right now it's quite calm, because when there is no bloodshed, things are more peaceful.
Does the government try to restrict your travel?
No, nothing. Except of not letting me go to Gaza, but no Israeli is allowed to Gaza. No Israeli. So it's not me. But in the West Bank, I go freely, and nothing. I have nothing with the government.
Can you speak a little, I know we're short on time, but just a little bit about the state of things in Gaza?
I don't go there, but my partner, she's Swedish, she was there just 2-3 weeks ago. I mean, before she left to Sweden, she was there 1 week before she left to Sweden. Haaretz is doing now something really remarkable. Every day, we give a table of how many hours in each town in the Gaza Strip they have electricity, and what time, because it's not only how many hours, but what time, you know, they have electricity between 2 o'clock in the morning and 6 o'clock in the morning,
yeah,
for example. So the whole house is doing all the laundry and everything between 2 o'clock in the morning and 6 o'clock in the morning. The situation is on one hand, you know, there is a report by the UN that by the year 2020, Gaza will, it will be impossible to live in Gaza, and we are 2017, by the end of 2017, and nobody seems to care a lot. Again, Gaza, as long as Gaza is not launching rockets, nobody cares about Gaza.
Well,
We taught Gaza that the only way to remind its existence is by violence. Because if they don't do anything, nobody cares about it. And when they do something, so Israel is destroying half of the Gaza Strip, and then there is some kind of interest, and after a few weeks, Gaza is forgotten. It's the biggest cage on earth. It's the biggest prison on earth. It's the biggest experiment in human beings. It's unbelievable that this goes on. We have to mention that Egypt is collaborating with this, because the siege is also by Egypt. Let's remember this, which makes our struggle much harder, because people tell me, what do you want? Egypt is taking part in this siege. So what do you want from Israel? Let Egypt, they are Arabs, they are in the same side. At least let Egypt do something, and Egypt is behaving really in a shameful way, shameful way. And the victims, as usual, are 2.5 million people, the nicest 2.5 million people, really. I mean, I love this place, Gaza. Those who know the West Bank and know the Palestinians, who most of them are really warm and nice. You met Palestinians. That's such true. Nice. When it gets to Gaza, it is, you have to duplicate it, yeah? They are warmer, they are more courageous, if you can generalize. Yeah, I mean, it's not politically correct to generalize, but Gaza is really a place that always touched my heart. People that I met in Gaza were unforgettable, both their courage, their devotion, and their warmth. Really warm people living by the sea, unlikely the West Bank, which who live more in the mountains or in the hills, makes people more open. When you live by the sea, yeah, you are more open. And now, in the last 10 years, I have no idea what's going on there. And on the other hand, what I wanted to say is that you see also, you see malls, you see hotels. I mean, not very clear how. I don't understand what's going on there, because there are malls, and there are some hotels, and there are some rich people in that. But the majority are living. I mean, it's unbelievable. And look how indifferent is the world about this. And when they come, all those Donald Trumps and others, nobody of them, now the General Secretary of the UN went to Gaza, but all of them don't even bother to go to see it. And the General Secretary of the UN said what he saw there is one of the biggest catastrophes he saw in his life, and he was there only a few hours.
You have been listening to a conversation with Israeli journalist Gideon Levy, speaking with a Tree of Life Foundation delegation from the United States, visiting Palestine, Israel.
Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, a weekly program devoted to the economic dimensions of our lives, jobs, debts, income, those for ourselves, those coming down the road, and those facing our children in the years ahead. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, and I hope that has prepared me well to present to you an economic analysis of what's been going on, particularly over the last week. Well, many of our thoughts and fears have been galvanized in recent days by the horrific events in Las Vegas. So it seemed fitting to begin this show by talking about an economic dimension of all of that that you may not have thought about and that the media coverage has not dealt with. Over 500 people injured, hundreds of them being treated in the network of hospitals in Clark County, which is the county where Las Vegas is located. But here's an economic dimension that makes a horrible story worse. We don't have universal health care in the United States, as you all know. And therefore, what's already beginning to happen is that the victims of this tragedy are already being confronted with bills from the county hospitals that have treated them. So that in addition to the trauma, in addition to the wound, they have that peculiar American addition, which is economic anxiety on top of everything else. So grievous is it that the Clark County Commission Chair, Steve Sisolak, has set up a GoFundMe account begging for charity to help defray some of the economic costs that are being imposed on the victims of this tragedy, random victims shot, because we don't have a national health insurance the way every other advanced industrial country does. Something to think about. I want to turn next to the question of tax reform, because that is what's on the agenda for the Congress. That's what's in the media every day, and I'm going to be talking about it repeatedly. And I'm going to take different parts of what's being proposed by the Trump and GOP administration that is trying to push this through the Congress. What I want to deal with today is one particular part, and that part has to do with so-called bringing the profits home. This has to be explained because it is as outrageous as anything I ever report on. Here's the story. Big corporations got the laws changed some years ago to enable them to do the following. If you can show that the profits you've earned as a big company, and I'm talking General Motors, General Electric, Apple, Google, you name it, big American corporations based in the United States. If you can show that you've earned profits abroad, which, as I'll tell you in a minute, is easy to do, you don't have to pay the 35% profits income tax that are required of all corporations working in the United States. So, for example, if you're a company that has a subsidiary, say, in Ireland, you sell what you normally do, but you don't sell it, say, to somebody in Ohio or somebody in Nigeria, it doesn't matter, directly from your headquarters in New York. Here's what you do. You sell what you produce in New York to your subsidiary in Ireland at a price equal to cost, so there's no profit there. Then your subsidiary sells it to your buyer, your customer, wherever he or she may be located, at the high price that makes the profit. In that way, you may be an American company, but your profits show up in the other country. They are therefore listed as foreign profits, and therefore they don't have to pay income tax. Not 35%, not 20, not 10, zero. Companies have been doing this for years. That's called tax evasion. Is it legal? Yes, it is, because the company is doing it, and others like them were able to get the law to read like that. Year after year, they avoid taxes, and therefore the government doesn't have the money to provide the services we all need. And therefore the government comes after us for more taxes to compensate the government for the taxes it can't raise on some of the biggest corporations in the world. Apple currently is listed as the number one corporation which has, are you ready, hundreds of billions of dollars in profits sitting overseas on which they have paid zero taxes. Does the government of the United States go after them for manipulating so the profits show up over there? No. Does the government go after them for using this as a tax evasion mechanism? No. Has the government made consistent efforts to change this law so it can get the taxes from these large corporations? No. But here's what Trump and the GOP propose. Bring the profits home now, you big companies, and we'll give you a break. We'll only charge you This is what Gary Cohn, the advisor to Mr. Trump, said this last week. We'll give you just 10%. Not 35, 10. You know what this is? This is a reward offered by the United States government to the corporations that have successfully evaded their share of taxes for years. And as if that weren't bad enough, we've been here before. Back in 2004, we did this the first time. We gave them a break. They could bring the money home. They got a lower tax rate. Did it lead to the jobs we would have when the profits came home? No, it didn't. And it isn't going to do it this time either. Why not? Because even though the profits are abroad, companies can use those profits to make money, which they do. It doesn't sit in a bank account. It's used to do whatever it's profitable for that company to do from Ireland or from wherever the profits are stashed. So it has no effect bringing it home. It just was a tax avoidance mechanism, and we're now going to reward these companies for doing that by giving them an even lower rate than they themselves expected. And guess what? If it's only for a year, which is what's being proposed, what is the message you're sending to corporations? As soon as this year is over, start doing it again, just like you did it before 2004. Just like you did it between then and now, do it again once this law, this window of opportunity is closed down again, because you'll save a lot of taxes and eventually another bought and paid for federal government will give you a special break as a reward. Someone say the system was rigged? Of course it is. And please understand that when major corporations stash, and by the way, the current estimate is over $2 trillion of money, profits earned by American companies stashed abroad. When they evade taxes on that money, either we have fewer services or we pay the higher taxes to make up for what they don't pay. That's the economics of it. Next thing, economic update. The Consumer Financial Protection Board in Washington keeps records on a whole lot of issues and does surveys of how consumer finances are going. And here's a statistic I wanted to share with you because it gives a window on the economic recovery we hear so much about but can't seem to locate when we go looking for it. One half of U.S. citizens, according to the Consumer Financial Protection Board, have trouble paying their bills. 50% have trouble paying their bills in the survey conducted by them. That's not an economy that has recovered. You're recovered when you don't have trouble, or at least when not 50% of your citizens report that. Next item. Some of you have asked me, what happened to the Soviet Union after it dissolved, 1989? And became Russia. When it gave up the socialism it said it had to go back to the capitalism before its revolution in 1917 to join the rest of the world's capitalist nations. And I thought you'd be interested in two statistics that come from a recent paper of the National Bureau of Economic Research. That's a famous source of all kinds of economic research in the United States. And the paper is entitled, for those of you that are interested, From Soviets to Oligarchs, Inequality and Property in Russia, 1905 to 2016. This is produced by the team of researchers that are based at Berkeley, Piketty and Saez, whose work I often quote because it is the leading work on inequality in the world. And their website, which you can find at Piketty and Saez, is where everybody goes in the economics profession for these numbers. Here's the story. When Russia went from capitalist to what it called socialist, it dramatically changed the distribution of income and wealth in Russia. From a very unequal distribution, it became radically less unequal. And when it collapsed in 1989 and went back to capitalism, it also went back to gross inequality. Before the collapse in 1989, the Soviet Union's distribution of wealth and income was much less unequal than that of the United States. Today, or as of 2016, the new Russia, the new capitalist Russia, has caught up with the United States and has a distribution of wealth and income rather like that here in the United States, that is to say, very unequal. You might also be interested to know that the NBER research I'm quoting indicates that wealth and income are much more unequally distributed in Russia today than in the People's Republic of China today. Something to think about. Next item. Eastern Europe is experiencing a surge of right-wing populist governments, Poland, Hungary, and beyond. What's going on? Well, what's going on can be described in many ways, but I would like to get to the core of the economics of it. When the Soviet Union collapsed in 1989, so too did the communist governments of Eastern Europe, one after the other. In some cases, it started even before the Soviet Union collapsed, as in the case of Poland. The hope of the Eastern Europeans was that by leaving the Soviet system, by joining the West, for example, by joining the European Common Market, in some cases by joining NATO, they would enjoy the economic standards of living that they associated with Scandinavia, Germany, and France. It was not their plan to join the economic conditions of Europe's poorer countries, Greece, Portugal, Spain, Italy, and so on. Unfortunately, what the hopes of the Eastern Europeans were and what has happened are not the same. Eastern Europe is now the poor part of a unified Europe. Eastern Europe is not achieving what it had hoped for. It is achieving a status much closer to that of Greece, Portugal, etc., etc. And why is that? Because they have become, in effect, colonies of Western Europe. If you look at the statistics, for example, the bulk of the banks in Eastern Europe are subsidiaries of Western banks who came in there once the Soviet Union was gone and gobbled them up. Likewise, the big employers in many of these countries are Western companies who went to Eastern Europe from Western Europe for one big reason: cheap wages, low standards of living. And they went there because that's what kept them there. They're not about to give those workers higher wages, to give them what they thought they would get in the West, because they didn't understand how capitalism works. They get low wages. They get to be the poor part of Europe. They thought that wouldn't happen. But they didn't understand how capitalism works. It's a little like the United States, where the poorest states are Mississippi, New Mexico, and the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico. These have been the poorest states for a long, long time. Capitalism doesn't erase these kinds of inequalities. Indeed, it often makes them worse, and it often keeps them for many decades. That's how the system works. Puerto Rico is in the process of being made even poorer than it was before. And it was the poorest part. I will come back to that in a few minutes. Eastern European people are furious at what's happening to them, furious at the Europeans, beginning to question joining the European Common Market, because the promise of being part of the European community has been broken. And right-wing politicians jumped, denouncing the rest of Europe, associating Europe with the need to take in immigrants from the countries that Europe is bombing in the Middle East, and fear that their situation will deteriorate even further if they have to share their meager economy with desperate refugees is turning people in Eastern Europe towards the right-wing politicians that express their anger and disappointment about Europe, coupled with their anxiety about immigration. It's producing right-wing politics in Europe, but then again, once the Europeans discover that the solutions offered by the right-wingers are nothing at all, who knows where they may then go? Next item. A sign of where Europe may go is already in the air. And that has to do with two political developments that are economic in their significance. One is occurring in the poor country of Portugal, and the other is occurring in the rich country of the United Kingdom. And I want to note it here so we can follow it in the future. Portugal had elections very, very recently. And in those elections, the governing alliance in Portugal, which had won the national elections in 2015, followed up by sweeping the municipal elections in Portugal this at the end of September, or the first day of October, excuse me. The government of Portugal is unique in Europe because it's clearly committed against austerity. It is not going to hurt the mass of people to get out of the economic crisis since 2008. Instead, it is giving money to poor people. It is built trickle up rather than trickle down, which is the austerity formula. The government of Portugal, in case you did not know, and why would you, given the media blackout? The government of Portugal is an alliance of three political parties: the Portuguese Socialist Party, the Portuguese Communist Party, and the Portuguese Anti-Capitalist Left Bloc Party. That's right. It's a left-wing government. They won the national elections in 2015. They just swept the municipals on the basis of, we are not going to make the mass of people pay for the financial crisis they did not cause and from which they have already suffered 8 or 9 years. We're going to help them first, and that's the way forward. And the people of Portugal have voted for them massively. And the other sign of the wind changing is in Britain. 6 months ago, the Labour Party leader, Jeremy Corbyn, was looked at as a long shot who could never win national office. Here we are, 6 months later. The Brexit negotiations between Britain and Europe are going nowhere fast. The cost to Britain is becoming clear. The Conservative government of Theresa May is not handling the situation well, and the newspapers are now full of the likelihood that Mr. Corbyn may become the next Prime Minister of England. And he, too, is a trickle-up, not a trickle-down politician. Very interesting that the winds of Europe are shifting. Next item. The New York Times recently bemoaned, as many people do, that banks in America, the financial system, isn't doing what it should do, which is loaning money to businesses who will hire people and provide jobs. And they shake their finger, they scold the financial industry. Well, far be it from me to defend the financial industry, but the New York Times is making an analytical mistake. The banks aren't the problem. They are just a symptom. The reason the banks don't do what it is you would like them to do is that nothing else in this economy is working in that direction. When they lend to businesses, it's mainly so the businesses can either move production abroad or automate jobs out of existence. If the businesses that the banks lend to are not job creators, but businesses in other countries creating jobs there, that's because it's more profitable, which is the way this system works, not just by banks, but by everybody. In short, the banks are not the problem because they are responding to the system. The system is the problem. It's the system that's not working, and picking out one part of it and putting all your anger on that misunderstands that each of the parts is doing what's profitable and avoiding what's difficult, and that's the problem. We have a system all of whose players are ending up doing things that we as a people don't need and don't want. The next item crossed my mind, and I didn't know how to present it to you, but I wanted to. It has to do with rural hospitals. They are closing. To give you the exact numbers, which I wanted to do, since 2010, 82 rural hospitals have closed in the United States. And 700 more are at risk of closing over the next 10 years. That's according to the National Rural Health Association, which keeps track of these numbers. The state that has suffered the most, Georgia. And I wanted to tell you the story of one part of Georgia, Wheeler County, caught my attention. The last hospital in Wheeler County closed in June of 2014. That brought the total number of hospitals in Wheeler County to zero. How many people live in Wheeler County? 8,000. 8,000 of our fellow citizens live in Georgia in a county that has no hospitals at all anymore. Yes, we pay a lot of attention to the tragedies of Texas, Florida, and Puerto Rico and the hurricanes. But an equal devastation not associated with nature at all, can't be blamed on nature, is happening across the United States as we let down our fellow citizens by being unable to provide a basic hospital service to thousands and tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands, with many more at risk. So poor are the reimbursement rates under Medicare and Medicaid that hospitals that treat older people who tend to have more medical difficulties and poor people who rely on Medicaid, those reimbursement rates can't keep the hospitals going. In a society that cared about its fellow citizens, we'd find other resources, wouldn't we? But we don't. We let the hospitals close, and then the people suffer. And we wonder why there's anger in the country, why some people become deranged under the pressure. Watching someone you care about die because you can't get to a hospital can have all kinds of effects on your mental stability. Puerto Rico. I wanted to end the first half of today's show with Puerto Rico. But before I do, I want to remind you, we maintain two websites that I want you to make use of. We update them every day. They are available to you without charge, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. One of them is democracyatwork.info. That's all one word, democracyatwork.info. And the other one, rdwolf, with two Fs, .com. These are websites through which you can communicate to us what you like and don't about this program. You can, with a click of your mouse, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Basically, be a partner with us. Use the material on this program and on those websites to share with others who are interested and might be induced to come and watch or listen to the program just like you do. Work with us. We try to work with you, and it will help the project we are engaged in building. For those of you interested in watching this program as a television program on a regular basis, please make use of our Patreon.com availability, Patreon.com. Patreon.com/economic update will get you right to it, and we would appreciate your taking a look at that. So back to Puerto Rico, our final economic update. Puerto Rico was taken over by the United States over a century ago in a war with Spain. It was, in effect, an American colony. And it never stopped being an American colony. It was given some privileges, such as having the people of Puerto Rico be American citizens who could travel to the United States without going through the normal visa and passport and other kinds of problems. But it was a undervalued, underserved, badly treated place, which is why so many of its citizens left Puerto Rico and went to the mainland. The behavior of the government now, the way it's been treated as a debtor, the way it is now not able to have its own elected officials run their society because a commission of the United States Congress has the final authority, the way that Mr. Trump neglected to deal with the Puerto Rican crisis after the storm. These are all symptoms, all a continuing sad story. Puerto Rico is the poorest part of the United States, even poorer than the states of Mississippi and New Mexico, which are the poorest states. It has the highest sales tax of any part of the United States. The poorest people pay the highest taxes. And now they've been devastated by a storm, most of the island without power, without communications. You know, you can tell the moral and economic fiber of a society by how it treats those who suffer the most and who have the least. And by that standard, the way we treat the colony, which is the truth of what it is, of Puerto Rico, isn't any better than the way all the rest of the colonies of the world were treated, which is why they rose up and refused to continue to be colonies a short while ago. It's worth thinking about. The inequality that makes Puerto Rico poor is being worsened now by the storm and the response. And that's on us. We've come to the end of the first half of Economic Update. Thank you very much for staying with us. After a short interlude, we will be right back.
I can see the Russian army rolling through my head. I've got inside of me lies the enemy. The other half is dead. I've got diamonds and I've got pearls. And I said, hey, mister, why don't you come for me? You can take me home, but I will never be your girl. I won't let your mystery unfurl. That's the whole thing about it.
Welcome back to the second half of Economic Update for this week. I am pleased at the beginning of this month of October to welcome, as I do at the beginning of each month, Dr. Harriet Fraud to talk with me and to talk with all of you about the intersection of economics and psychology, which is so important to shaping our personal lives, our work lives, and everything else. Quickly to remind you, Dr. Harriet Fraud is a mental health counselor and also a hypnotherapist with a private practice in New York City. She writes for a wide variety of scholarly and popular journals, and she is also writing now regularly for the Democracy at Work blog, which you can find at our website, democracyatwork.info. And she also has her own website, harrietfraud.com, and I'll spell that for you, HarrietFraad, harrietfraud.com. It is a pleasure to welcome Dr. Harriet Fraud to Economic Update.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Let me introduce our topic. We had originally planned a different topic for today.
Sex work.
But the events, and we're going to deal with that in the future, the sex work industry and what it means for our economy and our society. But the events in Las Vegas, from which I don't think this country will recover very quickly and which we're all still trying to understand and digest, struck us as so important that it touched the economics and the psychology of this country in many ways, and that it would be worth breaking our plans and talking about it. So let me ask you, since I know you specialize in these things, let me ask you, please, tell us a little bit about how the United States compares with other countries in terms of gun use, gun deaths, all of that kind of question, because it's important, I think, to understand the United States through the lens of that kind of comparison.
It's important. The United States has had more mass shootings than any of the other 10 most industrialized countries in the world combined. Where there are shootings in other countries, they're not at all like American mass shootings. They're politicized. So Breivik, who shot teenagers in Norway, was a fascist opposing the socialists by killing young people at the socialist camp. Our people are unpoliticized in the United States. Their rage at what's going on in their lives doesn't take them usually to a place we've got to change this as a group, but to lashing out personally. And a mass shooting, as defined usually and in the literature, is a shooting of at least four people to whom the shooter is unrelated, going into a place and randomly shooting people. That doesn't count the thousands that are killed by girlfriends and so on, but this is anonymous, an anonymous lashing out. And the United, although many other countries have guns, Canada has a lot of hunters, it has a lot of guns, they don't have the kind of weapons that the United States has at all. This person, Paddock, who shot all those people, killing 59, and there may be more because many are in critical condition at hospitals, and wounding 515 people, he had 41 guns. He took 23 with him in 10 suitcases when he checked in the hotel. And he had another 19 at home. Many were automatic. And he had thousands of rounds of ammunition. That's legal in the United States. It isn't anywhere else. We are the only nation which has prolific, unchecked gun use.
In preparation for today, I looked up some of the statistics in hopes that I could perhaps add something. And the two that stayed with me as I came into the studio this morning were that there is a measure of the number of gun deaths per 1 million of population. And there is a list of 10 countries that are high. Most of them are in the range of 2 or 3 to 7. The United States is the only country where the number is in double digits. It's
That's
about
true.
30. So you have...
No, it was 30 just for the month of September. And there have been 152 shootings since 2017. It's more. It's more. It's more than all those
deaths
combined.
No, not 30. Right. I mean 30 per million. In other words,
as
an average of what it is. And the other statistic that I recall is that the United States has 4% of the world's population, a little bit over 4%, and it has 43% of the world's privately owned guns, long and short guns. In other words, the gun ownership is 10 times the population percentage here in the United States. So I think it's fair to say that Americans, or United States citizens, have an attachment to guns, as well as to gun violence, that is out of proportion to that anywhere else, literally on the planet. So it does invite the question, what's going on? Why is this happening? Why is the attachment to guns what it is? And I was hoping, since this has to be at least in part a psychological question, what is it that attaches Americans, particularly now in our history, to guns on this scale? What can you help us understand?
Well, part of it is the media in which male gun violence is featured. Clint Eastwood, macho man, rides off alone, doesn't have any support system of other human beings he can count on, just like the fellow who shot the 59 people, Mr. Paddock, whose girlfriend was in the Philippines. We don't know whether she left. In my study of them, all of them previously have had either a woman who left them or a job that fired them. He had made $2 million and lived off of it as a gambler for 30 years, so he was not fired. We don't know what his girlfriend, Mary Lou, was doing in the Philippines and not with him. But those are the emblems of masculinity in our toxically gendered culture, having access to a woman who's loyal to you and having weapons. Now, it's a combination, as always, of capitalism's bloody hand and gender psychology. And what happens is that when guns are sold in the United States, they're not sold as buy a gun, make the gun manufacturers and the ammunitions producers who are wildly rich, even richer. It's buy a gun because it is your male freedom, because it makes you a real man, because it makes you able to defend your freedom. And so that it's all mixed up with toxic masculinity. That's why the gun shooters of all the mass killings are male. They're also overwhelmingly white, much more disproportionately white than whites are in our population. Because it's white men who capitalism has dethroned. They used to get double bonuses, one for being white and another for being male, in a scarce labor force where they were the manufacturing sector. A strong man could get a good job as long as he was white. Well, now that the big capitalists of the United States can export their jobs to people who make, you know, $38 a week, why bother with these white men? They've thrown them on the slag heap. Now, a lot of the jobs in our more service economy are held by women. And so that partly it's that they don't want to face that the people who dethroned them from their male throne are not women or minorities or immigrants, but the capitalists. They like to suck up and kick down. And they're happy to kick down on immigrants, women, and minorities. And the gun owners are laughing all the way to the bank. They also, politics comes into the mix because the NRA gave Trump $30 million for his campaign efforts and his inauguration. Therefore, Trump gets up, invokes God, and that this is an evil man, says nothing about guns, asks everyone to pray and to bring themselves together with family, which family he's bringing himself together of the three of them, we don't know, and to believe that God is the light and God loves suffering people. You know, really, Trump, who makes people loser, you know, makes people suffer right and left. But that, so it's politics is in there, capitalism is in there, and the psychology of building up men who have been dethroned through guns. There's an ad which is particularly illustrative for the Bushmiller automatic weapon.
Bushmaster, I think it is.
Bushmaster. Obviously, I'm not into this. But it says, does your girlfriend or wife earn more money than you? Revoke your man card. Do you prefer tofu to meat? Revoke your man card. And it goes through about 10 things. Then it says, buy the Bushmaster automatic weapon. Reinstate your manhood. So it's like buying testosterone cream. You reinstate your manhood. You've been dethroned. You no longer can support a dependent wife and children who work for you all the time, this wife.
So there's an argument, if I follow your logic, there's an argument that particularly white men have been systematically economically disadvantaged. They had certain kinds of advantages. They don't have them anymore. And they don't have the prospect of regaining them anytime soon either.
Or the perks that went with them.
So they get depressed in large numbers. The reason I raise this is economists have been struggling to explain something called reduced labor force participation. Particularly white men in the ages 25 to 60 are dropping out of the labor force. They need a job, they need income, but they are not, in fact, going back to get jobs. They don't want them, or they can't stand them, or they're dissatisfied with the income. This suggests, what you're telling us, is that not going back, dropping out, is a reflection of the depressed conditions of employment that they face. And it immediately suggests, if I follow you, and I'd like your opinion, that another way that a white male who's lost his job and can't get another good quality, say, manufacturing or construction job, one of the ways to shore himself up, particularly when he has no meaningful work he can get, would be this gun culture and the gun celebration. And if then you combine this sort of celebratory gun ownership with depressed people, then you begin to get the sense, well, if something unfortunate happens to that individual, you become not just depressed and have a lot of guns, but you actually use them in a socially destructive way. So
to reinstate your manhood. You know, you go down in a blaze of glory, reinstating your manhood through killing people. And I remember seeing a bus ad where there was a guy with a gun standing there and showing, I have the power. You know, that is male power. Another thing that's happening to men is that their suicide rates are higher than they've been for 30 years. Male children.
And again, it's the white
and
male
the white
rates
male that rate of suicide is going through the roof. Because their future, they can't see a future. We don't have a vibrant movement that really attracts people to a left alternative. Bernie began that and was shot down. And the fascist movement, luckily, the alt-right is not that popular. But they, too, recapture your lost manhood, make America great again, i.e. make America white again, and make you on top again. Now, most divorces are initiated by women because the old way was that women served men in the home in exchange for being supported economically and having a protected place to raise their children. Well, now they're not supported economically while they're expected to do the lion's share of housework and childcare and get jobs. And it's a bad deal, even in the red states, where divorces are even greater than they are in the blue states, women initiate divorce.
Which means, again, to go back to something you said earlier, that there's going to be a sizable part of the white male population that is disconnected from the kinds of jobs they either once had or expected they would have, and also, in a sense, dethroned at home as
Absolutely.
Well as at the workplace.
Personally and professionally.
So that if these two things come together in the same individual, we can see a level of stress and anguish and bitterness that could then, in people who have a personal problem of one kind or another, explode in the manner of this Mr. Paddock.
Particularly if they don't have a movement to go to which explains it to them and helps them have the power to be a group of people who take their country and make it serve them instead of only the rich. We don't really have that kind of vibrant movement. That's why in Europe, where people do killing, they do it in the name of a political goal, not here. It's random and personal. And what's very interesting is to look at the history. I find that just amazing. Between 1949 and 1966, there were no mass shootings. between 1966 and 1984, there were no mass shootings. Starting in 1984, they became more and more frequent. Until now, they are very frequent. There have been 152 in 2017. Huge. And if you, there's a wonderful book by Mark Ames called Going Postal. And it looks at the beginning of what happened with mass shootings.
In the 1980s.
In 1984 was the first big one. Right. It's called Going Postal. Because it began with the post office, a rash of shootings at the post office. Because Reagan was the first to start smashing up the American dream, to start smashing up the unions with the traffic control workers and others, to start changing the estate tax and the taxation rate on the wealthy to make the middle class and the lower pay it all. And what the post office had a powerful union, 30,000 people, very progressive union. And Reagan began just about at, you know, before these killings, substituting the supervisors who used to be elected from between, from among the ranks and understand what went on, with business school graduates who saw the postal workers in an adversarial way, pushing them harder and harder to do more and more, and promoting those who complied, creating enormous rage. It was the beginning of the crunching down of the working class. And with that, the rage at not being able to make a living, have a decent job, have control over your life that you could see, okay, I'll do my job, I'll do it well, I'll be connected on this in this job, in this union, I will then retire, I will have a pension, I will support my wife and children, their dreams will be greater than mine. I'm a blue collar, they'll be a white collar. There, I'm a white collar, they'll be a professional. That's dead. That doesn't happen anymore. And
so the argument,
their male perk of being, I am a man, I support my family, that's over.
So that the argument you're making that comes from Ames is that in a sense the post office crisis and explosion, we didn't know it then, but was a harbinger
of
what was
going to
happen in a wider and wider range of jobs, particularly in well-paid blue-collar work, but also in other professions, driving, you know, people to feel, particularly white men, disconnected from the workplace and the work culture, and also dethroned at home. Because what I appreciate so much about what you're telling us is that the economics and the psychology are being brought into the story. We're not being left with the empty statement, it's evil, or the empty blaming of the individual. No one is going to defend Mr. Paddock for the horrible damage he did. But this is, because of the history you've shown us, this is a social problem. This is affecting large numbers of people, even though there are particular reasons why this individual or that individual is the one who blows up finally. If we don't deal with the social problems, we're allowing the pressures then to build up that will explode in one or another individual on a growing scale, as you've shown us has already happened.
Absolutely agree. And one of the things that Mr. Paddock illustrates is a problem that American men have. Usually their only emotional connection is with their sex partner. And if she leaves, they're utterly disconnected. As the country music song says, you've been thinking and I've been drinking. Now, male alcoholism is going way up along with drug abuse, but that one of the things that happens is that men are emotionally disconnected, especially if they're not working and even having the camaraderie on the job, even if it isn't intimate divulgences and secrets. It's a sense of being part of something. This man had not been working on a job for 30 years. And his girlfriend was in the Philippines. I don't know whether she was leaving or whatever, but she certainly,
wasn't with him.
She sure wasn't with him. And that women, when they have an emergency, connect. they found, because they always used to only study men, that the fight and flight idea when something's terrifying in women is fright and connect. When women are in trouble, they connect with their women friends, and they usually have stronger bonds emotionally with other women than they do with their husbands. They connect with their families. They connect with their children so that they are not emotionally abandoned when they're not on the job. And usually they describe the killer not only as a white and a male, but a loner. Doesn't talk to his neighbors, doesn't have friends, disconnected from his family. He hadn't talked to one brother for 20 years. The other was a couple of years when he had inquired about his mom's health. You know, that he's a disconnected man because connection is crucial to mental health. And there's a toxic idea that you're not a real man if you cry, if you need support, if you need help, if you reach out to others. And that is a terrible blight, particularly as men have been dethroned from their white male family wage status because they don't get a family wage.
So their lack of connection is happening historically at the same time that their job and home situations put them in greater need of connection than ever before. That is an unbelievable pressure on these people, and it begins to make it remarkable that there aren't more explosions of violence or whatever, and the gun is simply the mechanism for the expression of all of this.
And taking back your manhood, you know, your manhood, take back your manhood, reinstate your manhood, because it's associated, they're taking men who are feeling dethroned and unmanned, and they're giving them the masculinity back with a gun by saying, this is about your freedom. This is about your manliness. This is about your right to defend your family. This is about reinvoking your manhood, giving it back. This is me. And people are desperate. You know, there have been 152 mass shootings in 2017, and we're not even done. You know, we have four more months, but that it's really no wonder, and that has to be looked at rather than this is pure evil, which is what Trump said quite conveniently. It's also ironic that the NRA, which did give Trump $30 million and is politically pushing this point of view, they even have a target you can order from the NRA called the ex-girlfriend target, where you shoot it and it starts to bleed until its face is demolished and its whole body is blown away. They don't have a comparable boyfriend target because it's overwhelmingly a male thing. And ironically, they started this Harvest Festival, Route 91 Harvest Festival, to give the NRA a gentler image by starting a country music festival. And it was at this festival that 59 people were killed and 515 were wounded, many critically.
What do you think should be done?
Well, I think the first of all, it's rather a broken record with me, people need a movement. What Bernie started has to be built. There has to be an alternative where people can come together and say, this is our land. This land is your land. This land is my land, as Woody Guthrie said. And that it doesn't belong to the bankers who happen to own most of it in property. We can take it back. We can take it back as we did in the New Deal. We can take it back with the tax rate on the top that is the 94.8% tax rate. We can take those 2.3 trillion that are in overseas investments back. The Canary Islands are not going to set out a military force to oppose us.
I wish, as always, that we had more time, especially for a crisis situation that this Las Vegas event has kind of brought us in. you wonder and you hope whether maybe people will think about it in a new way and understand that political connection might go a long way, if you actually had it, to overcoming the lack of other connections that you have so clearly explained is a root cause of this kind of an event. So thank you very much. And when we meet again at the beginning of November, we will resume our conversation that we had planned about the economics and psychology of the sex work industry.
Thank you. Glad to be here, although I'm sorry about the circumstances of the topic.
I want to thank you all. We've come to the end of our program at this point. I do want to remind you of something I said at the very beginning, that the tragedy of Las Vegas is compounded in all of its horror, its psychological horror, the wounding and killing of people, many of them young, early part of their lives, cut off, their families hurt. I do want to say that it is an added economic horror that we now have a fund set up, a charity, to help defray the medical costs of the wounded. It's really almost unspeakable. In any case, thank you for joining us. We want to talk to you again next week. Let me remind you of our two websites, rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info. Please be a partner. I want to, as usual, thank truthout.org, that remarkable independent source of news that has been a partner with us. Join them, join us, and I look forward to speaking with you again next week.
This is Pacifica Radio's Letters in Politics. I'm Philip Muldery, filling in for Mitch Jeserich. On today's show, we're going to be talking with Chris Hedges about the end of empire. The empire he's talking about is the U.S. empire. We'll see what he thinks. How will it end? And then we're going to talk to Lisa Graves in Wisconsin about that gerrymandering case that appeared before the Supreme Court this week. So all of that coming up on Letters in Politics. But first, the news.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandary. Senior congressional Republicans say they're open to considering legislation banning bump stocks, like the shooter in Las Vegas used to make semi-automatic rifles perform like fully automatic weapons. The comments from the number two Senate Republican John Cornyn and others marked a departure from the usually solid wall of Republican opposition to any new gun safety laws. It's still far from certain that California Senator Dianne Feinstein will win passage of the legislation she introduced yesterday with 26 Democratic co-sponsors. Feinstein said her measure would ban the manufacture, sale, and possession of devices like bump stocks.
We have now witnessed the deadliest mass shooting in United States history. Nearly 60 killed and more than 500 injured. Those numbers are simply stunning. In just 9 minutes, an individual was able to turn a concert venue into a battlefield. One person, 9 minutes, utter devastation.
Texas Republican John Cornyn said the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee is interested in convening a hearing on the issue. Republican Homeland Security Chair Ron Johnson said he favors banning the devices. The National Rifle Association successfully has held off congressional action on gun safety measures after previous massacres. It did not respond to inquiries about its stance on Feinstein's bill. Authorities investigating the massacre say Stephen Paddock may have planned to attack another larger concert. They say the Las Vegas shooter rented an apartment in a Las Vegas high-rise over a music festival the weekend before the massacre. They also say Paddock had a plan to survive the shooting and try to escape, though they wouldn't say how. Paddock's partner, who returned to the U.S. from the Philippines this week, said in a statement read by her attorney that he had given her no warning that something horrible like this was going to happen. The House has passed a $4.1 trillion budget plan promising deep cuts to social programs and government agencies, but whose chief purpose is to set the stage for massive tax cuts later this year. The measure won approval along party lines. The plan calls for more than $5 trillion in spending cuts over the coming decade, including a plan to turn Medicare into a voucher-like program for future retirees, slash Medicaid, and repeal the Obamacare health law. Today is the deadline for young immigrants brought to this country as children to renew their DACA status, protecting them from deportation. The two-year renewal applies to DACA recipients whose status would otherwise expire by March 5th. The Department of Homeland Security says nearly a third of those eligible had not yet applied. The program is set to expire next March unless Congress approves legislation legalizing the status of the young people known as Dreamers. Republicans have said they want immigration enforcement measures as part of any new legislation. At a Washington rally this morning, the group United We Dream called for a Clean Dream Act.
So what do we want?
Clean Dream Act!
When do we want it?
Now!
What do we want?
California Senator Kamala Harris said the Dream Act is a first step toward comprehensive immigration reform, but she said the immediate priority is for eligible DACA recipients to renew their status by tonight's deadline.
Let's get those applications in before midnight tonight. Let us fight each and every day between now and the end of year to pass a Clean Dream Act. And let us understand that we are on the path to ultimately do what is really the goal and the right thing, which is that we must pass comprehensive immigration reform.
California Senator Kamala Harris. Iraq's prime minister says troops have retaken the northern town of Hawija from the self-styled Islamic Straight group, driving the group from one of its last strongholds in Iraq. Haider al-Abadi declared victory during a press conference in Paris with the French president. His translated remarks appeared on Al Jazeera.
We have liberated Hawija, and in this regard, we have only the borderline with Syria to go. So we have beaten terrorism, and our armed forces, despite all the difficulties, have achieved big progress fighting terrorism in Iraq.
IS now mainly is concentrated in a region straddling the Iraqi-Syrian border. It also still controls a cluster of towns in the far west of Iraq's sprawling Anbar province. Even as the Iraqi government drives IS fighters from their last remaining pockets of territory, Iraq faces a new challenge in the form of a growing Kurdish push for independence. U.S. officials say three U.S. Army Special Operations commandos were killed and two others wounded when they came under fire in the landlocked West African nation of Niger. The officials said the commandos, who were Green Berets, were likely attacked by fighters of al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. The Pentagon said the U.S. forces are in Niger to provide training and security assistance. I'm Eileen Alfandary. Letters and Politics is next.
Again, I'm Philip Muldery, sitting in for Mitch Jeserich, who's having a well-deserved vacation this week and next week or two. Right now, I'm joined on the phone by Chris Hedges. Chris is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist with the New York Times. He is the best-selling author of many books, including Wages of Rebellion, The Moral Imperative of Revolt. And he's also a regular columnist at truthdig.com, where he most recently wrote a piece called The End of Empire. Chris Hedges, welcome back to KPFA.
Thank you.
Let me ask you, this TruthDig article, well, before I get there, that last story in the news about three U.S. Special Forces being killed in Niger, did we know that we were fighting in Niger?
Well, we have deployments all throughout, small deployments all throughout Africa. I'm not sure Niger is on most American radar screens.
That's what brought it to my attention. It's like,
yeah.
It seems like the U.S. empire is at war everywhere, at least in Africa. But in the meantime, your most recent article in Truthdig is a review of a book by historian Alfred McCoy, and his book is titled In the Shadows of the American Century, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power. I can't remember who coined the term American century. You might recall that. Which century was that?
Well, it's the century of McCoy is referring, in essence, from the end of World War II until roughly 2030, when he thinks the American empire, as we know it, will no longer exist. And there are many strong indicators that if it doesn't come in 2030, it's going to come pretty close to 2030.
Well, you are in agreement with McCoy that, in fact, the U.S. empire is in steep decline. What are the factors that you look at when you make that determination?
Well, there's a series of factors. We can begin with the steady deterioration of the U.S. economy, and the projections of growth. The Department of Agriculture has predicted that the American economy will grow by about 50% over the next 15 years, while China's economy will triple and probably surpass the American economy in 2030. In 2010, China became the world's second largest economy. That is the same year it became the world's leading manufacturing nation, which pushed aside the United States, which had dominated the world's manufacturing for a century. We have reports from the Department of Defense, including one called At Our Own Peril, DOD Risk Assessment in a Post-Primacy World, that just flatly states that the United States no longer enjoys an unassailable position versus state competitors, that it can't automatically, these are their words, generate consistent and sustained local military superiority. And we have all the physical signs around us. The plague of deindustrialization, the collapse of our most basic infrastructure, our public transportation system is in shambles. Our bridges and roads are collapsing. Our schools are crumbling, underfunded, being privatized. Half the country lives in poverty or near poverty. And yet we do what all empires have done, and that is expand beyond our capacity to sustain the empire itself. And, of course, what holds so much of it up, as McCoy points out in his book, is the fact that the dollar remains the reserve currency. But the moment that the rest of the world, much of the world, which is already beginning to happen, shifts away from the dollar, that will have a devastating impact on the U.S. economy. Because we won't be able to pay for these deficits by selling treasury bonds, or we can sell treasury bonds, but they'll be so devalued that we won't be able to fund this kind of military adventurism. The cost of imports will skyrocket, unemployment will explode. I think as McCoy and I and others have written, this economic devastation will trigger pretty serious forms of hyper-nationalization, proto-fascism, which we've already begun to see with the Trump White House. And these, you know, kind of moments in imperial decline, we can look at the end of Rome or anywhere else, traditionally cough up these figures like Trump, who eschew diplomacy and multilateralism and politics for bombastic threats and the instrument of war.
Well, Trump partially got elected by talking about the devastation of American economy, the devastation of the deindustrialized Rust Belt, the craters in his inaugural speech, sort of a devastating attack on the conditions of Americans in the working class and the industrial heartland of the country. So just on face value, it sounds like he is reading the same tea leaves as you and McCoy are reading, or not.
No. He is, in the sense of appealing or telling the electorate or the public what they want to hear, that he'll impose 35% tariffs and that all the jobs are coming back. He's a con artist, obviously. So he's read the zeitgeist in and the mood of the public. But we have watched, since he has been in power, this call for 10% increase in the military budget, which the Pentagon didn't even ask for, this acceleration of a corporate kleptocracy. Of course, he has his personal kleptocracy, but a corporate kleptocracy. We see it with figures like DeVos in the Department of Education. These hedge funds realize that the government spends about $800 billion a year on education, and they want it. That's what this is about. So there's a kind of cannibalization of the very system that holds the government together, which has been going on before Trump came into power, but has gained speed under Trump's. This was kind of laid out by Karl Marx in his understanding of the late stage of capitalism, when you would see corporations unable to sustain profits at past levels begin to consume the structures that hold the state together. And so it preys upon the state. We saw it with the bank bailouts, for instance. In the name of austerity, it puts greater and greater burdens on an impoverished working class, on the poor, driving them deeper into debt, diminishing the capacity of the state to serve the needs of citizens, while it will relentlessly relocate jobs, including in professional positions, to countries with cheap pools of labor, mechanized workplaces, and essentially create what we've created, which is this kind of rapid death spiral, an economy that in essence is built on the scaffolding of debt expansion. And there is going to come a moment when there aren't any markets available, there aren't any more pools of people who can take on more debt. And this is what happened with the subprime mortgage crisis. And once they can't conjure up new debtors, this scheme kind of falls apart and crashes. So that's very much, for instance, why corporate oligarchs hoard such vast sums of wealth, $18 trillion, I think, in overseas tax havens, and won't spend it. Won't invest it in the system. So everything is coming together, and McCoy kind of lays that out in the book, for an inevitable kind of collapse.
Once again, I'm speaking with Chris Hedges, and McCoy is Alfred McCoy, a historian who has written the recent book, In the Shadows of the American Century. I took a look at the statistics about what percentage of the gross domestic product different countries spend on the military, and found it sort of interesting. First, 10% of the Saudi Arabian income of their gross domestic product goes to the military. Then we have Israel and Russia, both over 4% of their gross domestic product spent on military. Then comes the United States at 3.5% of gross domestic product. And then following the U.S., Britain and France with about 2.2, Germany about 1.2, and it trails off from there. So 3.5 of the GDP of the U.S. going to the military is way ahead of Western Europe and way ahead of the rest of the planet, with those exceptions, Saudi Arabia, Israel, and Russia. So,
well, we should also be clear that a lot of the military spending is mass. So our whole nuclear program is funded out of the Department of the Energy.
So it's off the books.
It's off. It's on the books, but it's off the military budget. So
right. So you're saying it's more than 3.5%?
Yeah, it's close, probably close to about $1 trillion a year. I mean, especially if we count the money we spend on intelligence. We have 16 intelligence agencies, many of whom have black budgets. So in fact, this is not an accurate statistic in terms of the actual money that we invest in a kind of bloated military. You know, nobody even audits. They don't even audit the military anymore. They haven't audited the military for years. It's just they're a world unto themselves. And, you know, it used to be a few decades ago that you would get liberal Democratic senators that would actually challenge itemized military requests. That's all gone. Not only do they get everything they want, no matter how, superfluous it may be to national defense, but of course, under Trump, they're getting even more than they asked for.
So you talked about the deindustrialization of the U.S., and there are various excuses put out there, including the notion that countries like China or Mexico or Brazil, in fact, are not innovative economies. They're copycat economies, and that they largely do the work that is repetitive and menial, and the real high-tech stuff continues to happen in the U.S. What of that argument?
Well, it's not true. I mean, in terms of production of supercomputers, and along with many other cutting-edge technologies, it's coming increasingly out of China. And part of the problem, again, goes back to the American system of education. We're not producing people with those kinds of technical expertise. It's part of the reasons why corporations hand out visas to foreign workers from India and other places in order to fill these positions. Now, that, and McCoy spends a lot of time in the book talking about it, that is one of the many indicators of precipitous decline within the American economy, is that while it was true that at one point we had a kind of technological edge on the rest of the world, that is evaporated.
So if that has evaporated, we're talking essentially about a working class that is going to go nowhere, or a working class that is going to be in the position of sending raw materials overseas or agricultural commodities. We're going to be the provider of those commodities to the people that actually turn them into industrial goods. Is that what you're saying?
Well, that's already happened. The Chinese have been buying up natural resources in order to feed their technological sector, not only in places like Africa, Latin America, but also in the United States itself. This forebodes very ill for the American working class, which already lives on wages that are probably below subsistence level, and is having whatever benefits workers had in the past stripped from them. And that descent from an already very difficult position is going to have political blowback. It's going to have kind of very frightening consequences for the political landscape itself.
Chris, in the campaign of last year, you were a staunch opponent of Hillary Clinton and characterized her as someone who would do great destruction to the U.S. economy and the American people. How do you regard that now that we've had Trump in office for what is it, 9 months?
Well, I mean, Trump is the monstrosity everyone knows he is. But it was the bankruptcy and perfidy of the Democratic Party that created a figure like Trump. Trump is the symptom, not the disease. And what led us to this moment, and it very similar to the kind of economic breakdown that I covered in Yugoslavia, was the assault on working men and women carried out by a Democratic Party, and primarily under Bill Clinton, that wanted corporate money and got it. So you had NAFTA, which was the greatest betrayal of the working class since the 1948 Taft-Hartley Act. You had Clinton's gutting of the welfare system, and 70% of the original recipients on welfare were children. You had the deregulation of the FCC, which allowed roughly a half dozen corporations to seize most of the airwaves. You had the Omnibus Crime Bill in 1994 that exploded the prison population and doubled, tripled, quadrupled sentences. You had the destruction of Glass-Steagall, which took down the firewall between investment and commercial banks and precipitated the global crisis. And Clinton knew very well what he was doing. He wanted corporate money, and by the late 90s, the Democratic Party had fundraising parity with the Republican Party. But this assault destroyed the country physically and created a dysfunctional political system. It was, in essence, a corporate coup d'etat, so that you have all branches of government, including the judicial branch, serving corporate power, taking from us constitutional rights by judicial fiat, including the right to privacy, reinterpreting corporate money through acts or rulings like Citizens United as a right to petition the government or a form of free speech. And so it was inevitable, as Ralph Nader, who I worked closely with, pointed out long ago, that this kind of stripping down of the country, cannibalization of the country and war on the working class is going to create political mutations, and that's where we are. So, I mean, if Clinton had won, it might have bought us another 4 years. But a Trump or someone like Trump was inevitable, a demagogue. And he has, you know, very frightening qualities of a traditional demagogue, including that kind of buffoonery that oftentimes makes people underestimate the damage these figures can do. And so we have to look at what was the root cause. And that, again, going back to Ralph, when he began, especially in 2000, his argument was that we had to pull 5, 10, 15 million people out of the Democratic Party to defend the interests of the working class and begin to put fear within the organization so that it would respond. Unfortunately, it didn't work, and this is where we are.
So, Chris, you said if Hillary had been elected, it could have bought us another 4 years. That's sounding mighty good to me right now, given what we're facing with a Supreme Court, a House, a Senate, a White House, all doing their best to destroy the lives of the majority of the American people. Buying another 4 years sounds preferable to that.
Well, of course it does. But the question is, how are you going to stop the engine of corporate power that has devastated this country and essentially caused our political system to seize up in a form of paralysis so that it serves corporate power and a tiny oligarchic elite and increasingly imposes burdens working men and women can't handle. That wouldn't stop under Clinton. And we had to find a mechanism by which we could push back against this Democratic Party assault, and that was third parties. Buying another 4 years would have been great, but the direction that both the Republican and the Democratic parties, who were each beholden to corporate interests, was taking us made this inevitable. I didn't want it to come now. I would have loved to have had another 4 years to push back. But we have to, I think, name those forces that got us into this mess, and it wasn't those of us who were supporting third-party candidates.
What about the Democratic Party? Has it learned any lessons from this phenomenal defeat?
Unfortunately, it doesn't look like it. And I think we have to recognize that the Democratic Party doesn't function as an actual political party. It's kind of constant mass mobilization and public relations hype. And figures like Pelosi or Schumer, or certainly the Clintons, they know that they wouldn't exist unless they were bankrolled by Wall Street. And so that's why you have seen so much pushback against the Bernie Sanders wing after the election. I think we could argue that, of course, in a fair primary campaign, one that wasn't ruled by dark money, Clinton spent about $1 billion on this election. If independents had been allowed to vote in all of the primaries, and many primaries they were banned, which constituted the base of Sanders' support in many cases, they stole the Nevada caucus. I mean, in a fair election, Clinton would not have stood a chance. But everything we've seen after the election goes to show that this leadership, not only by demonizing Russia and refusing to name their own complicity in creating what happened, but by their attack against every element within the party that seeks a kind of more progressive stance, shows that they are gambling essentially, as they did during the last presidential election, that enough people will repudiate Trump to put in a Democrat, whoever that is. And I think that's a very dangerous and very short-sighted tactic, one that may not work.
Well, I just read in this morning's San Francisco Chronicle an article that indicates that all the money spent in campaigns for TV advertising, direct mail, robocalls, all of this has very little impact on voters' choice of whether to vote for the Republican or the Democrat. And in fact, the biggest thing that a progressive could do would be to convince people to vote, period. People are so disgusted with the system that they stay home. So it would seem that, quite frankly, if it's black money, whatever money, it doesn't. They're not getting what they're paying for.
Well, no, they are getting what they're paying for because they have convinced, probably correctly, a huge segment of the population, especially the working poor, that doesn't really make any difference. They're screwed either way, and that is a correct analysis. Obama didn't do anything for the majority of African-American people, nor did he do anything for the working class. He was, as Cornel West says, a black mascot for Wall Street. So they've read the political system correctly. And if there was a candidate who, and I think that was part of what led the insurgency of the Sanders campaign, who actually stood up and was willing to fight on behalf of working men and women, they would go out and vote.
What of the notion that Bernie Sanders would have been red-baited mercilessly?
Oh, of course.
And that would have more or less tied a can to his campaign.
Well, the corporate elites would have done everything within their power to destroy Sanders as they destroyed Henry Wallace. And Sanders was no Henry Wallace. He would not speak out against empire. He was very tepid in terms of his being critical of Israel. And the war crimes Israel commits. Yeah, they would have done everything in their power to destroy him. Look what they did to McGovern. There's no question. But we have to confront these forces. Otherwise, we're finished. Both as a democracy and finally because they're rapidly degrading the ecosystem on which we depend for life.
Well, we're going to leave it there. Chris Hedges, again, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, formerly at The New York Times. His most recent book, Wages of Rebellion, The Moral Imperative of Revolt. The article we were talking about earlier appears in truthdig.com, where Chris Hedges has a regular column. This piece was called The End of Empire. Chris Hedges, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be right back talking about gerrymandering. Four minutes after the hour here on Letters and Politics. Again, I'm Philip Muldery, sitting in for Mitch Jezerich. Earlier this week, the Supreme Court had a hearing on a case coming out of Wisconsin. The case is Gill versus Whitford. It is about political gerrymandering. In the state of Wisconsin, after the 2010 census, Republicans controlled both the governor's office and both houses of the legislature, and they drew lines on the map that distinctly advantaged Republicans running for all offices, really, in the state. Those lines determine the districts that people run from, and consequently, who are the voters that those politicians will be answerable to. Joining us on the phone is Lisa Graves. Lisa is executive director of the Center for Media and Democracy, which is a national watchdog organization based in Madison, Wisconsin. Lisa Graves, welcome to Letters in Politics.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
So I gave a brief rundown, but I'm sure you can elaborate. What did they do in 2010 with the drawing of these lines?
Yes. So every 10 years, as most people know, there's a census in our country to establish the population. That census is required by the U.S. Constitution. And after that census, then legislatures across the country engage in reapportioning, basically determining how many representatives there will be, to Congress based on the population of that state. And so every legislative cycle, basically after those 10-year marks, there are redistricting things that happen across the country. In Wisconsin, what happened was that that 2010 election also coincided with the midterm elections for President Obama, which is known as the Tea Party surge, after there had been a lot of money by the Koch brothers and others to really push forward this sort of reactionary set of politicians. And so when 2011 came around, those Republican leaders in the state of Wisconsin allocated substantial tax monies, nearly $500,000, to basically a private set of lawyers and firms to try to create the most partisan map they could possibly create. And they used a computer program to test against all sorts of possibilities in terms of other swing elections in the succeeding years, as well as, how they could just, through fractions of moving district lines, ensure virtually permanent Republican majority until the next census, which is coming up in 2020. And so that's what happened. There was boasting about that, bragging about that behind closed doors. There was even a non-disclosure agreement that those Republican legislators signed as part of gerrymandering the districts. And after that election, what had happened in the next election cycle, Republicans won just slightly less than half of the vote, but they ended up with a majority in the legislature. So for example, the Democrats won over half of the statewide vote, but got only 39 of the seats in the assembly.
39 out of
99 out of 99. And so you have a situation where you have a majority of people in the state who voted Democratic, who were a majority of states who are Democrats in Wisconsin in those elections, and yet the Democrats were not in the majority in the state house, in the assembly. And in the next cycle after that, it was even worse. The Democrats lost seats, and there were fewer seats that were, potential swing seats as a result of this districting. And so you basically have a situation in which you have minority rule, in which the party that actually is the minority party, just in terms of the number of voters in a state, actually holds a majority of the legislative power in the state, in the assembly, and in fact holds a substantially disproportionate amount of that power. So it's not a 51-49% state assembly. It's actually much bigger than that, the majority that they're able to carve out through this really distorted gerrymandering of the district lines.
So gerrymandering is almost 200 years old here in the United States. It goes back to New England, where a politician named Jerry drew the lines for districts, and people looking at these lines on the map said it looked like a salamander, and consequently we get the word gerrymander. And in the past, drawing these lines has been used for many purposes, not just the contest between Republicans and Democrats, but also in an effort to devalue the votes of African Americans, particularly in the South, but not exclusively so. And in the past, the federal courts and the Supreme Court have found that gerrymandering for the purpose of denying African Americans their rights to be represented was in fact unconstitutional. But this is the first time that the Supreme Court is really prepared to address whether drawing these lines to advantage a political party is unconstitutional. So would you explain how it's different if you gerrymander for race or if you gerrymander for political preference?
Well, I think in this instance, you have in some ways really a hybrid of that. You have both, because there was there was certainly evidence presented at the trial court level that talked about how excited some of these legislators were to really minimize the impact of the cities of Milwaukee, for example, there's a disproportionate number of voters in those cities, who are African American. It has an impact based on race, and those legislators know it has that impact in terms of just the breakdown between the parties, the racial disparity within the political parties. So I think you have both in this instance, but in this scenario, this isn't just drawing lines, and then the next time around, 10 years later, there's another line drawing, and it's just the luck of the draw. In this instance, with the computer technology that's available, that legislature at the time in 2011, could basically secure their control until the next legislature. Effectively, because of the sort of partisan divide in the state, make it so that this legislature isn't sort of a 51-49 or 52-48 legislature, but make it so that they would control that legislature for almost to the end of this. It's now 2017, and we're at the same place again on the eve of that 2020 census. And so that type of control, as one of the lawyers in the case that was arguing the case before the Supreme Court told Justice Ginsburg, the lawyer Erin Murphy said, this is a precious right to vote, and if legislatures can stack that vote so that the election results are preordained, then why should people, why should people be able to go to the polls? Now that lawyer, was arguing, she conceded that point in essence about the impact on the vote, but the reality The reality, as Justice Sotomayor said, is, you know, is it really okay for the legislature of 2011 to stack the deck for a decade? And that's what's happened in the case of Wisconsin. Then why do we even have elections every 2 years if they can stack the deck, you know, in that fashion? And so I was, you know, heartened by the fact that some of the justices asked hard questions, including Justice Kagan, but also Justice Kennedy, who was appointed by President Reagan, because I do think, and I do think that there is, it's not just routine sort of routine district drawing. This is a new sort of extreme level where they have used the computers to basically, you know, try to make it impossible. You know, not just hard, but impossible in a way that I think that there are solutions for the court to intervene and to set aside the Wisconsin districting scheme and try to come up with a role that makes sense for having a representative democracy, because it's certainly the case that if you are in a majority Democratic state, for example, and your legislature is a majority Republican, you are not actually being really represented in this democracy. I mean, that's an unquestionable reality. We obviously have a bit of a similar issue nationally with the anti-majoritarian reality of the Electoral College. But the Electoral College is something that needs to be addressed separately. This is about just the baseline representative democracy in terms of our legislatures, which are supposed to be representative and not counter-majority, not counter-democratic institutions. That districting is supposed to be pro-maximizing democracy, not counter-democracy.
Again, our guest is Lisa Graves, who's Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy in Madison, Wisconsin, talking about the case of Gill versus Whitford that was argued before the Supreme Court earlier this week on gerrymandering in the state of Wisconsin. Here in California, we certainly have had gerrymandering as well. Gerrymandering exists almost everywhere in the country. In California, it was done by Democrats, not Republicans, to guarantee seats in Congress and in the state legislature for Democrats. Due to a voter initiative in California, that system was thrown out, and now we have like an independent body that is supposed to be either nonpartisan or bipartisan that draws the lines. It has resulted in huge majorities for the Democrats, both in Sacramento as well as in the congressional delegation that's sent to Washington. But that's a reflection of the fact that the state of California has registration that's overwhelmingly Democrat as opposed to Republican, with a big chunk of independents in the middle. Let me ask, essentially, the problem for the Supreme Court is going to be how do you make a decision at the Supreme Court that would prohibit gerrymandering and at the same time allow judges to have hard and fast rules to know a gerrymander when they see it? Or are they supposed to very subjectively say, I don't like that district, it has a funny shape, and it would seem that the devil is in the details here?
Well, I think, you know, I think that in this instance, I think you have such, in this case, you have such a demonstrably distorted outcome in terms of how those districts were drawn. I think it's actually a really strong case. I think Paul Smith, who was the advocate for the people opposing that map for the, you know, and we submitted a brief in that case to the Supreme Court. But I think his arguments were really compelling in terms of talking about how extreme this situation is, and if the court does not intervene, that it would really harm the court's reputation and you know, signal continuing erosion of our democracy in ways that are significant. If this sort of extreme gerrymandering is allowed to stand,
but how do you decide what's extreme gerrymandering against the run of the mill old fashioned gerrymandering?
I think in this case you can look at the statistical deviation, which is substantial, and also what the lower court ruled and what other some other jurisdictions have pursued is the sort of commission or nonpartisan commission, like what Iowa does, and some other states have pursued to have a baseline redistricting that deals with changes in populations in various areas as part of that map, but that's not done toward that particular partisan end. So Iowa has a majority of Republicans in its legislature, but the map is not drawn in order to serve the agenda of those Republicans. The map is drawn on a neutral basis in ways that don't sort of try to maximize those sorts of variations. And in this instance, a map could be drawn. A map could certainly be drawn in Wisconsin and other states that would be a fair map, that would not have this really distorting impact. And you could assess its distortion level, I suppose, by different statistical analyses, but it's not as though it's impossibly done. This is a sort of map that's created by humans. It's a map that can be, it's a problem that can be fixed by humans. It's not preordained. And in fact, in Wisconsin, it's so extreme that it has, you know, in essence had the effect of denying people, in my view, really the basic principle of one person, one vote. I think it's possible, and certainly that the lower court judge is more articulate than me in describing, you know, how such a revised process would work. But it has worked in other jurisdictions, and it has worked in ways that aren't trying to basically nullify the majority in the state, rather than actually have that majority be represented in a way that is actually representational.
So this judge you're referring to essentially has come up with a mechanism that would allow for fair district line drawing?
There were guidelines in the lower court ruling that would help establish that basis. And then, as I mentioned, beyond that, there is, you know, an actual functional working model in this country, which many people refer to as the Iowa model, that engages in that very act. And so it's not just a theoretical solution. It's an actual solution that has worked in other states.
Again, Lisa Graves, my guest with the Center for Media and Democracy. So I gather from the questions by Justice Kennedy in the argument earlier this week that he is somewhat on the fence and, in fact, could strike down the district lines in Wisconsin. But, you know, it's a rather slender reed to put all our hopes on Justice Kennedy. Are you hopeful?
Well, I'm hopeful. I mean, I think this is a situation in which this court is, this Supreme Court remains a very divided court, and Kennedy has been the decisive vote in a number of rulings that have been significant, in my view, for vindicating basic human rights in our democracy. Unfortunately, Justice Thomas and Justice Alito, Roberts, and the new judge on the court, Neil Gorsuch, seem to be very hardline partisans who vote in pretty much in lockstep. And then there are the Democratic appointees who, you know, have been the swing vote, who voted with the swing vote with Kennedy. So I'm hopeful about Kennedy, but you don't know how he's going to vote. I feel like in this case, if he looks at the precedent below in terms of the ruling by the district court as well as the ruling by the circuit court, that was a divided circuit court decision. But they said that, you know, while some of these issues of partisan gerrymandering can be difficult, they specifically ruled that this was a far more straightforward case because of the way that the Republicans acted, the statements that were conceded on the record. Former Republican staffers testified about what happened in that case. There are people who were involved in the computer program who have since basically changed their position based on the outcome in that case in terms of how they were used. And you have this incredible secrecy, the shroud of secrecy that these members put on this case, so much so that you think about the fact that elected officials in this state using taxpayer monies hired an outside firm to do this and then were willing to sign a non-disclosure agreement to hide the information about how it was created from the people, the taxpayers, who paid for the redistricting. It's an astonishing sort of backroom backroom deal that they engaged in at our expense, at the public's expense. And I think that when you look at the lower court decisions, both of them, you can see that this case provides, I think, a very compelling case for Justice Kennedy to do the right thing here and to order that this map be redrawn. But I don't have any hope that the other four Republican appointees will do the right thing at all.
So unmentioned in all this conversation is Scott Walker, your governor, who is a Republican and is definitely the hatchet guy as far as this redistricting has gone. He gets reelected statewide. Effort to recall him failed. So in general, it doesn't sound like the people of Wisconsin are so angry about what's happening in Madison, the state capital, that they would throw Scott Walker out of office. So the other side seems to have the Trump card here.
Well, if you look at what actually happened in the 2011-2012 recall, the 2012 recall of Walker, is that there was so much outside money, dark money being brought in. Walker was raising money from corporations out of state. He was asking for million-dollar checks that would otherwise be barred if they were given to his own campaign. Instead, they were going to what's known as a C4 organization, a nonprofit, and the people were writing on the check lines for Scott Walker's C4, and that money was being spent to distort the result in that recall race. And in fact, that activity, that level of coordination with people who were involved in his campaign and then were involved in coordinating this whole set of ads by these so-called independent groups was subject to a criminal investigation in this state. And that criminal investigation was proceeding in good faith, investigating the activities of the Walker team in basically stealing that election. And that investigation was shut down by a partisan Supreme Court in the state that included judges who should have recused themselves because they themselves benefited from some of these same dark money groups who were acting to get them elected. And so I think that 2012 race is a scandal, you know, for our democracy here in the state. It is the case that he won, but he won in part because of the dirty politics that was played, doing activities that at the time I believe were illegal, and that the prosecutors were pursuing as illegal, and that would perhaps have been vindicated as in fact illegal had a partisan and distorted state Supreme Court here not shut that investigation down. And you can read more about the documents that came out of that investigation in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and in the Guardian, because the fact is that investigation showed, at least the evidence that was provided to those papers, showed that there was misconduct by Scott Walker at that time. Now, subsequently, he did win a subsequent race for his governor's seat. He's up again next year. So we'll see what happens in the meantime.
Is he running for a third term?
I believe he will be seeking that third term. He's now the head of the Republican Governors Association. That was his reward for his failed presidential race. He was given the helm of the Republican Governors Association. RGA is basically a group that just passes mass amounts of money back into these races, coordinating with these sorts of state groups. It's a group that in Walker's original race for the governorship in 2010 received a $10 million check from billionaire David Koch and from, you know, Texas building billionaires and more. And it's a big cash cow. So I don't think it's fair to really say that Walker's winning because he's just so popular. I think we can't underestimate the impact of these dark money groups on the election process here in the state and in other states. It's been deeply influential in some ways and distorting.
Well, Lisa, we're going to have to leave you shortly. Again, Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy, you have a website, right?
We do. Our site is exposedbyCMD.org. And we also
Oh, do that again. You did it so fast. Expose?
Exposed by CMD. That's EXPOSED. BYCMD, Center for Media and Democracy, exposedbycmd.org, and that leads you to all of our other sites. That includes information about dark money, information about the Koch brothers, information about this case before the Supreme Court, and information about our work nationwide to expose these dark money influences that are distorting our democracy.
Exposed
bycmd.org.
And I just might mention that Wisconsin is highly segregated, de facto segregated, but I think you've already mentioned that the city of Milwaukee has a large African-American population, but the suburbs are overwhelmingly white. And the result is if you just put all those people in the city of Milwaukee into one district, you've essentially combined all the Democrats in one place.
That's exactly how it looks. And there's a great meme online that's called How to Steal an Election, where you can see how a majority can be carved out and made into a minority through this sort of clever and I think, you know, deceptive, deceitful, anti-democratic activity as happened here in Wisconsin with this extreme partisan districting.
Well, Lisa Graves, thank you again for joining us and keep up the good work.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, that does it for Letters in Politics. The show is produced by Deanna Martinez, Abby Klinkenberg, and Lucille Rousseau. Our interns, Radha Keel, is our engineer. You can find our archives online at kpfa.org. I am Philip Muldery, filling in for Mitch Jeserich, wishing you a good day.
Renegade economists Marilyn Waring, Kate Raworth, and Eleanor Ostrom, a TUC radio miniseries on how to resist the demands of permanent economic growth and protect the earth, indigenous communities, local agriculture, and women. Kate Raworth, Why It's Time for a New Version of Human Prosperity. Kate Raworth came to international attention in 2017 with the publication of her most recent book, Donut Economics, 7 Ways to Think Like a 21st Century Economist. She critiques the gross domestic product system of accounting, including the so-called green or sustainable growth models. As you listen to her talk to health professionals in London in December 2016, imagine 2 circles, one inside the other, forming a hole in the middle. That's the donut. Based on the work of Earth system scientists, Kate Raworth graphs 9 planetary boundaries into the outer ring. They spell danger when crossed. Among them are climate change, ocean acidification, water depletion, chemical pollution, etc. The problem is that we already overshot the limits of at least 4 of the 9 boundaries. Inside the smaller circle, in what we call the donut hole, she places a graphic representation of people without health care, food, water, education, a job, access to energy, and more. In Kate Raworth's donut model, the goal is to raise the well-being of humans trapped inside the donut hole while placing limits on climate change and pollution that are near or have crossed the outer circle of the donut. Kate Raworth is teaching at Oxford University's Environmental Change Institute and at the Cambridge Institute for Sustainability Leadership. Over the last 2 decades, she has worked as senior researcher at Oxfam and as co-author of the United Nations Human Development Report. In this talk, she refers to her co-presenter, Kevin. That's Kevin Anderson. He's a frequent guest on TUC Radio. And she offers an apology to the audience. Here's Kate Raworth.
I know it's early in the day, and I apologize for bringing junk food into the room already, especially to health professionals. I've had so many medics and doctors write to me saying, I love your concept, but did you have to call it a donut? Do you know how unhealthy these are? So all I can say is perhaps I'm going to introduce you to the one donut that might actually turn out to be good for us. And I hope I can explain why. So in the 20th century, the shape of progress was very simple. It was this ever-rising line measured in GDP growth. It's the dominant paradigm, the dominant metric. We hear it in our politicians' language every day. The trouble is, it brought two things uncomfortably with it. It's brought extraordinary inequality. Now just 62 billionaires own the same wealth as the poorest half of the world's population and sail around in these very high-carbon ships. And at the same time, it's brought extraordinary degradation, which Kevin has just spoken so eloquently and passionately about. And this is a very uncomfortable problem to have when you live by a growth paradigm. So what can our politicians do with that? It's clear that they are searching for a better language to describe what progress looks like while they're still wedded to growth. And I call it playing growth bingo. So I listen every time I hear a politician talking about growth. What word do they stick in front of it? So Angela Merkel has talked about sustained growth. Barack Obama wants long-term lasting growth. David Cameron called for balanced growth. But you can have it good, you can have it green, smart, smarter growth, equitable, inclusive growth, anything you like, just so long as it's growth. Of course, some of these politicians have already gone. And so I've been listening carefully to what those coming say. Theresa May just talks about economic growth. She says she wants Britain to be the greatest meritocracy in the world. But when she talks about economic growth, she doesn't add any word in front of it. I'm still trying to figure out what she's doing with this concept. But Donald Trump, he's very clear. He's stripped away all these nice adjectives. He's just pro-growth. And that's alarming because it means we're going back, we're going away from the nuance, we're going away from the change. So when it comes to change, I'm extremely inspired by the extraordinary American inventor, Buckminster Fuller, and his wide words. You never change things by fighting the existing reality. To change something, build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete. And so in that spirit, I don't want to stick adjectives in front of growth and try and amend it, appease it, or make it more palatable. I want to come up with a completely new model. And it turns out that that model looks rather like a donut. So let me tell you what this donut is. On the outside of it, the outer ring of the donut, is, let's say, an environmental ceiling of pressure that we can put on the planet's boundaries before we tip this extraordinary, fragile, living Earth on which we depend out of the benevolent state it's been in for the last 11,700 years that's been so incredibly generous to humanity that we've managed to thrive. In 2009, a group of leading Earth system scientists got together and said, what is it about the last 11,700 years, it's been an extraordinarily stable phase of planet Earth's history. How can we understand what those are? And to me, these people are like planetary doctors. Medics have spent hundreds of years examining many, many, many individual human beings and learned the parameters of the human body, and that's what we call modern medicine. It's why so many of us survive. My children, I have eight-year-old twins, and when they were very little, I knew that if their temperature went above 38 or 39 degrees, I had to completely focus on bringing it back down because we call that a fever. It's too high, and it must come back down. So we know the parameters of pressure that we can put on the human body. Well, I think of today's Earth system scientists as planetary doctors for the 21st century. But instead of hundreds of years of practice and knowledge, it's been going for about 30 years, so it's incredibly new science. And there's only one planetary body on which to experiment and explore. So it's a much trickier challenge to understand the health of our planetary body. But it's the very same questions. How many different systems are interacting? What's the equivalent of the planet's respiratory system, nervous system, muscular system, skeletal system? And how much pressure can we put on any one of those systems before we kick it out of balance and tip Earth from this benevolent phase of life into ill health for humanity for sure? And they said they believe there are 9 key Earth system processes that we have to stay within, to keep ourselves within these 9 planetary boundaries. So Kevin has talked a lot about the top one there, climate change, ensuring we don't put so many greenhouse gases in the atmosphere that we cause the Earth's temperature to rise with so many extraordinarily damaging impacts. But there are others. We mustn't withdraw so much water from Earth's freshwater systems that we actually transform the hydrological cycle and stop the flow of rivers. But we mustn't put so much nitrogen and phosphorus fertilizer into cropland that leaches out. It doesn't get taken up by crops. It leaches out into the sea and lake bodies, and it causes eutrophication, changing those bodies green, absorbing all the oxygen and killing off aquatic life. Other ones include ocean acidification. So much carbon dioxide gets dissolved in oceans that it acidifies the water, killing off sea life. Chemical pollution, whether the chemical is plastic or persistent organic pollution or chemical waste or all sorts of products that humankind, these novel entities that we create, we don't yet fully understand how they interact with the fabric of life and change, even at the DNA level, change life forms. We mustn't put so many atmospheric aerosols, little tiny particulates up in the air that we see as smoke or smog. They cause smog for human health, but also they can change where the monsoon occurs. They move the monsoon patterns across countries. The ozone hole, the release of CFC gases opened up this great big hole in the ozone layer, and we know that we must then close that because the ozone layer protects us from ultraviolet light that causes skin cancer and damages so many living organisms. Biodiversity loss. If we transform the surface of Earth's land and reduce biodiversity, we not only lose an extraordinary range of living organisms, but we also create monoculture and lose the resilience that is embedded within diversity. And the lastly one on land use change, if we transform the natural state of land's Earth's surface and turn it into farmland and cities and highways, again, we're reducing Earth's capacity to absorb carbon dioxide for sure, but also the resilience of diverse landforms. So the Earth system scientists said, we think these are the 9 planetary boundaries that we have to keep an eye on to stay within safe levels of pressure on each of them, because they're all interdependent. And if we push ourselves over these risk boundaries, we really risk kicking Earth out of the safe space that's been a human home for over 10,000 years. So where are we on those planetary boundaries? They plotted them on a chart, and you can see we're well over the climate change boundary. We're way over on the nitrogen boundary and way over on the biodiversity loss boundary. In fact, they've updated this science, and they say we're also far over on the land use change boundary and on the phosphorus boundary. So we are already over at least 4 of the boundaries. They haven't yet managed to quantify aerosol loading and chemical pollution, so we could be over on those as well. We don't know. They are huge unknowns. But we are already way over planetary boundaries. But is the answer to come right back within planetary boundaries as if we were putting no pressure on the planet? Is the answer to use no fertilizer at all, to withdraw no water from Earth's rivers and lakes? Is the answer to transform none of the Earth's land surface? No. Because that would be death and disease and destruction for many millions of human beings. We have to engage with Earth's resources to provide for our own needs. So when I saw this diagram of the 9 planetary boundaries and drawn as a circle, and I was sitting in Oxfam, and some of my colleagues over there were responding to food crisis in the Sahel, and others were campaigning for health and education for all worldwide, I thought, if there are outer limits of pressure beyond which lie unacceptable environmental degradation, then so too there are inner limits of resource use and pressure, below which lie shortfalls in human well-being or human deprivation. So in that blue circle lies human deprivation in terms of the most basic needs of our lives, whether it's healthcare, food, water, education, basic income, having a job, having a voice in society, being resilient, having access to energy, and having these things with social equity and gender equality. And I crowdsourced these from the world's governments in the run-up to the Rio Plus 20 conference. So these were the 11 top priorities of more than half of the world's governments, the social priorities that they saw. And they, most of them, in fact, all of them, have been since embedded in the Sustainable Development Goals. Where are we on those social foundations? Well, if every human being in the world had the resources to meet their human rights, that entire inner circle would go orange. But you can see there's these blue areas of deprivation remaining. So, for example, on food, 13% of people don't have enough food to eat. For income, 21% of people live on less than $1.25 a day. So now what happens when we put these together? We've entered the 21st century already having exceeded three, even four planetary boundaries. We have gone into a risk zone where we risk tipping Earth out of the stable home that it's been for us for centuries, for millennia. And yet many millions of people worldwide still cannot meet their very most basic needs. To me, this is the extraordinary indictment of the path of economic development that has been pursued over the last, and asking us, can we actually come back into this donut-shaped space, ending human deprivation and environmental degradation at the same time? And to me, this is the generational challenge. Fiona said, can we balance hope and despair? We can be desperate when we look at the extraordinary overshoot and shortfall. And we can be hopeful when we see a positive vision of a world we want to inhabit. What if we could be the generation, because as Kevin says, we have to be the generation that begins to turn this situation around, that actually starts putting humanity on track for being within the donut rather than pushing ourselves further outside of its safe and just space. So what if each of us put our own lives on a little donut-shaped table and asked ourselves, how does the way that I live impact on humanity's ability to come within this safe and just space between social and planetary boundaries? How does the way that I eat, travel, shop, bank, vote, volunteer, demonstrate, help my neighbours, how do all these ways that I live impact on social and planetary boundaries? What if every company in the world actually drew up its corporate strategy at this donut-shaped table and asked itself, is the way that we're producing product actually undermining people's human rights and pushing the planet over planetary boundaries? Or can we transform who we are as a business and what we produce and how we produce it and what we stand for so that the core practice of our business is actually helping to bring humanity into this safe and just space? There are companies today that are taking on that challenge and trying to transform their business. What if you were sitting around this table as a set of healthcare professionals asking yourselves, how could we create a healthcare system that brings humanity into this space that meets the health needs, but also the rights, the voice, the resilience, the gender equity, the social equity needs of everybody within social and planetary boundaries? What kind of healthcare system would do that? What if every urban designer, every planner building the cities of the future, because there are going to be many more, had a donut-shaped diagram on the table as a compass, as a vision for the city they wanted to build? Well, I know that might, if that sounds ridiculous. The interesting thing is that there are people doing this right now. I was contacted by a group of urban planners in Kokstad, which is the fastest growing town in KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa. And they said, we love this donut diagram. We took it in 2012, the municipality of our town worked together with the local youth, and we drew up a vision for our town, for what we want, for how it's going to provide for everybody's needs within planetary boundaries. And the best thing that they did, under the social foundation, they added one extra dimension, which was fun. They said, we're going to live within social planetary boundaries. We're going to have fun while we do it. So there's the hope. But also, it's not just happening in South Africa. In Sweden, some designers contacted me, and they're designing and building a new suburb of Stockholm, about 15 minutes by train, called Kimlinge. And they said, we love this donut, and we are setting out to design the most sustainable city districts in the world. We want Kimlinge to be the first one, but we want to replicate this worldwide. So again, taking a positive vision of social and planetary integrity and saying, how can we redesign the world around this? So there's a vision, but what would it actually take to bring ourselves into this space? For me, one of the key questions we need to be asking, Kevin started asking it this morning, what key factors shape humanity's ability to move into this safe and just space? Six of them come up time and time and time again, so I'm just going to talk briefly about six of these issues. Population, inequality, aspiration, education, governance, and technology. So I'm going to start in a place that people are often afraid to talk about, with population. Because population does matter. It really matters how many of us there are. If we want to meet the human rights of all people in the world, We need to care about the number of us in total, because the more of us there are in total, the more that the requirements for meeting that social foundation are going to increase. The thing about population is it's not the one that keeps me awake at night, you see, because in the early 1970s, Paul Ehrlich wrote a book called The Population Bomb, and population was this great scare story, as if this is the population growth curve, exponentially growing, and it looked like it was exponentially growing in the early 1970s. But actually, what population is doing is quite the opposite. It's plateauing, right? A very subtle difference of the arm from the exponential growth curve to a plateau. It's gone through an exponential phase, but it's plateauing off. And the great thing about population growth is we know how to slow down the growth rate of the human population. I'm sure all of you know, because it's got a lot to do with medicine. It's about child health, women's reproductive rights, girls' education, and women's empowerment. And these things are a magic list of factors that if you empower women and provide decent health care, women are empowered to take control of the size of their own families. And this is how we slow down and stabilize the growth rate and stabilize the size of the global population. So this is not the one that keeps me awake at night, because there are other things like GDP growth that are still on the exponential curve, and we haven't figured out how to make them plateau. What about inequality? I mentioned that 13% of people in the world don't have enough food to eat. How much would it actually require to give them enough food to eat? It would take 3% of today's global food supply to ensure that everybody had enough food to eat. And that is in light, right? 3%? Well, right now, 30 to 50% of food is lost post-harvest, wasted in the supply chain, or scraped off plates in the kitchen. So we're looking for 10% of what's not even being eaten at the moment. This is in one measure of the scale of extraordinary inequality that there is in the world, not just in terms of income, but access to the most basic of resources of food. Kevin already mentioned that 45% of the world's carbon emissions are produced in the name of just 10% of people. I call them the global carbonistas, and we know we're part of it. Many of us are part of the global carbonistas, living on every continent with a high carbon lifestyle. But also, one-third of the world's sustainable nitrogen budget. So if we brought nitrogen use back within what's seen as a sustainable level by planetary boundary scientists, one-third of that is used to produce meat and dairy for the EU. So kudos to the woman who wanted a lot of vegetables, to the man who said beefless diet, and the person over here called for allotments. The way we eat and the way we eat in high-income countries has a huge impact on global carbon emissions. So, aspiration. I'm going to move on, for I've done population and inequality. Aspiration. We have lived through a century that has encouraged consumerism and selfish individualism. It's the PR industry. It's the advertising industry. It's the engine of consumerism that sends us out every Easter and Halloween, and here we go Christmas, and then it'll be Valentine's Day, and then it'll be, you know, coming around. All these holidays we're encouraged to go out. Black Friday taking root in this country. Why are we taught to find status in what we buy and what we own? And we need to transform that to finding meaning in community, in experience, and relationships. And that experience, of course, is a picture of people hiking up a mountain. Of course, it also matters how you get there. So you can't fly in a high-carbon flight to go and have a wonderful natural experience. We need to be consistent in the whole vision of what we're doing. But transforming those aspirations, whether it's for love or for bringing care back in, this is a profound transformation. And we have been put through this century of consumerism. And, you know, step out into London, it's all around you. Advertising is everywhere. How on earth are we going to undo the lock-in, the economic lock-in of advertising and consumerism? Technology. There are many, many different technologies you could use. So on the top here, I've got pictures of different suggestions that people have used for combating climate change. You could stick mirrors in space and reflect the sunlight back, or you could stick solar panels on the roof of your house. How about supplying enough food for the world? You could encourage community gardens and enable small groups of farmers to save their own seeds and grow their own food. Or you could grow high-tech biotech food in scientifically controlled laboratories and own seed by corporate owned. All of these are possible solutions, but they have very, very different impacts, both on planetary boundaries and on social outcomes, social distribution and social justice in terms of voice control of technology. So they have multiple impacts. And often one of the reasons for looking at 9 planetary boundaries together is because sometimes people come up with solutions for climate change, which will actually aggravate problems of biodiversity loss or problems of food shortage, as Kevin was talking about, looking at in terms of the use of biomass as a means of creating a low-carbon society, all sorts of other ramifications. You cannot look at climate change in isolation from the rest of it, from the social story and the other planetary boundaries. And let's remember that behind these choices are many, many companies, whether they're fossil fuel companies, car companies, high-tech companies, food companies, with huge lobby power and lobby interest in terms of which technology is chosen. So these technologies are not being chosen in a vacuum or in terms of a calm, rational policy decision-making choice. It is strongly influenced by vested interests. Which brings me on to governance. Whether it's teamwork or collaboration, governance matters from the very local to the global. And I've just brought here one example of global governance. If we could see that picture of the planet as a video, you'd see the clouds moving continually, shifting between and over continents. They don't recognize national borders. But as humans, we have divided ourselves into these little plots of land from Afghanistan at the beginning to Zimbabwe at the end, and many, many in between that we call countries. And then we come together, whether it's at the United Nations or the Paris Agreement, and so often negotiate from short-term national self-interest and find it so hard to rise above that and seek long-term common collective global human interest for future generations as well as today's. And that's just the global governance story. And we've seen the problems of that played out over more than 20 years, resulting in the Paris Agreement, which is deeply inadequate. But there's even an agreement there. Many of the other planetary boundaries don't even have an agreement process going on. So from the local, the way you relate to your neighbours across the garden fence, that's part of governance as well. And if we can't do it with our own neighbours across our garden fences, how can we expect the United Nations to do it? So we have to transform the way we govern ourselves from the very, very local to the global. And that brings me lastly to education. And it's one I'm passionate about, particularly about economic education, but all kinds of education. We need to transform the paradigms that we're using to understand the world. So if anyone here has been to an economics lecture, let's imagine if this was an economics lecture. Anybody, what was the first diagram that you would learn in economics? Shout it out. Supply and demand, there you go, you learn the supply and demand curves, right? The little crisscross of the supply and demand lines. It's magic. Kevin had a lovely picture of a magician pulling a rabbit out of a hat. To me, this is economists pulling a rabbit out of a hat, because the first diagram you learn, before anyone even mentioned it, the economy apparently is the market. That is what the economy is, and it's about supply and demand. And apparently the market and prices pull the economy into equilibrium. Well, the equilibrium is just not true at all. The economy does not exist in equilibrium. It's a complex, ever-evolving, shifting system. It's not mechanical. But the economy is not just the market. There's the household economy. All of us came from household economies this morning, and anybody who got kids up today definitely came from a household economy, of raising the next generation, feeding, cleaning, washing the dishes. It's reproducing ourselves as labour in the economy. But there's also the role of the state, and there's the role of the commons. So there are many forms of economy, and mainstream economics just takes us straight into the market as if that's all there is. We have to deeply enrichen our understanding of what the economy is and what it's for and who we are in it and how it moves. So I wish the first economics lecture didn't begin with supply and demand. I wish it began with the donut and the question, what kind of economy would bring humanity into this space? And that would be a completely different economics degree. And that's from my passion of reinventing education. This is where my passion lies. So I left my job at Oxfam because I wanted to pursue this even more deeply. And I've just spent the last 2 years writing a book. It's called Donut Economics, 7 Ways to Think Like a 21st Century Economist. I used to be ashamed to call myself an economist because it was so inadequate as a way of understanding the world. But I'm reclaiming that word, and I call myself a renegade economist, because economics means household management. And what could we need more today than planetary household management in the interest of all of its inhabitants? So I want to reclaim the idea of what economics is and what it's for. And I very much hope I'll come across your paths in that process. Thank you very much.
That was Kate Raworth, author of the 2017 book, Donut Economics. 7 Ways to Think Like a 21st Century Economist. She spoke on December 10, 2016, at the Conference by MedAct in London. She's teaching at Oxford University and the Cambridge Institute for Sustainability Leadership. This is part three of a TUC radio miniseries on renegade economics and how to resist the demands of permanent economic growth and protect the earth, indigenous communities, local agriculture, and women. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org, and the mailing address is Post Office Box 44, Calpella, with a C, like cat, Calpella, California, 95418. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. The ways different creatures, especially us humans, use our senses to guide ourselves through life has long attracted my curiosity. I've often wondered how blind people seem to be able to orient themselves, and often wondered about their dreams. From time to time over the years, I would see an attentive woman walk past my office window next to a young person of student age. They would walk together, and the young person almost always carried a white cane with a red tip. Laura Fogg is this woman, the author of Traveling Blind, Life Lessons from Unlikely Teachers, and she was our guest in this archive edition of Radio Curious. Laura Fogg worked as a mobility and orientation instructor for the blind in Mendocino County, California, for over 35 years, beginning in 1971. She pioneered the use of the red-tipped white cane with very young blind students, some of whom had multiple impairments. She traveled long distances over the rather spectacular back roads of Mendocino County to work with each student in his or her home. When Laura Fogg visited the studios of Radio Curious on December 1st, 2008, I asked her about the lessons that she learned in this work that have changed her life.
The lesson that was the most important one for me has very little to do with blindness or the world of education. It has more to do with just learning how to accept people for who they are. Working with all of these students that I write about in the book and countless others through my career here in Mendocino County, I have encountered families and children who I never would have ever spent much time with. And because these are children, I have to get to know the families so the families will trust me enough to take their kids out into the community and teach them how to travel blind. And therefore, I'm in people's homes and I'm making friends with people that I just wouldn't have gotten to know before. So the lesson to me, I was raised to be rather judgmental of other people who are of different social or economic or cultural backgrounds than I am. And what I realized working with and getting to know and love some of these families is that the background is pretty irrelevant, and who they are as people is the most important thing in the world.
What stands out?
In terms of a family?
Of changing the way you were raised so that you became not as judgmental as you were in your growing up and when you took this job.
Well, there was one child, I called her Shayna in the book, and she was totally blind from birth, and so therefore I had to work with her quite a number, two or three times a week. And I met her when she was only 2 years old, so I did spend a lot of time in her house. And the first time I went there, it was a really poverty-stricken environment with a mother who was chain-smoking and non-communicative with me, the sort of person that I would have dismissed completely.
When you arrived at her home, you were pointed into the house. She said, yeah, Shayna is over there in the house, and just signaling you to go in by yourself.
Yeah, the mom just stayed out on the porch smoking. She didn't even, accompany me in to meet her little daughter. And it was a pretty terrifying experience for me because I didn't have the self-confidence to find a way to take charge of this situation. I was a guest in this woman's home, even though she was making me feel like an extremely unwanted guest. And I still had this job to do, to go in there and meet her daughter and start to try to figure out, what do I do with this child? And from this very strange, difficult, unsettling beginning, Shayna's mother became one of my favorite people who I've ever met. And she taught me more about life and more about acceptance and more about just plain old honesty about who you are.
Of what she taught you, are there any particular experiences, the aha moment that you remember that you could share with us?
Well, one of them was there were two experiences. One of them was when my own mother died, and my mother and myself, we had kind of a difficult relationship. There was not a lot of expressed love, and I was distraught. And this woman, Shayna's mother, of all the people who I talked to in the week or 10 days after my mother's death, Shayna's mother was the one who just, what she said and what she did went straight to my heart. There was this human-to-human contact, and nothing mattered. It didn't matter that I was her daughter's teacher. It didn't matter that I had a job and made more than she did. It didn't matter that her house was dirty. Nothing mattered.
How did that contact come about? What did she say to you that brought it?
I don't remember the words so much. I remember the action, and it was, she was a very young mother, much younger than I was at the time, and completely disorganized, because of her own disabilities and her own background. But what she did was she took charge of that moment. I brought her little daughter home from a lesson and told her about my mother's death. And what she did was she walked over to me and she put her arms around me. And it was a very welcome experience for me, and this understanding all of a sudden that, whoa, this woman who I have dismissed as being incapable of so many things, because I'd spent all this time trying to teach her how to teach her daughter, and I wasn't getting very far. But I realized that this young woman knew more about life than I did. And she had more guts than I did, because she reached out to me in the most healing manner. And she was very calm about it. And very understanding I think it was just that empathy and that understanding that was the most amazing part of that experience. And I got it on some level in that moment that this whole relationship was not about me trying to teach her. That was the platform where we started. But the relationship that was forming was just about two human beings learning how to relate to each other and caring to keep trying to relate to each other and to keep trying to learn from each other. So it became very much of a two-way street that, you know, my teaching her and teaching her daughter was only half of the picture. And if I had any sense, I needed to hang around and learn what this woman had to teach me. And that was where the title came from, is not only this family, but many others, or the subtitle, Life Lessons from Unlikely Teachers.
In what ways have some of the other families and children you've been with touch you in the way that brings tears to your eyes, like telling this story does here? Well, right now,
I think a lot of them. Another one that was real—I'll probably cry all the way through this one.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
This is Radio Curious, and
yeah.
We're talking with Laura Fogg, who wrote "Traveling Blind: Life Lessons from Unlikely Teachers." I'm Barry Vogel, and Laura has some more life lessons that she's learned to share with us.
Yeah, another one. It's another student in the book, and I called her Michelle. And Michelle, we discovered, was dying of a very strange, rare, inherited metabolic disease. And she was one of my favorite students ever. She started out, she was the best reader in first grade, and very bright, very gregarious, and somehow or other stopped being able to see what was up on the board. And stopped being able to see what she was reading. And her blindness was diagnosed first as a hysterical conversion syndrome, which is a strange psychological thing, until finally they took her to the hospital, they took her down to UC, and discovered that she really did have this real condition. And going through her worsening condition was, you know, with her was another one of those huge, big experiences for me because, you know, again, I was raised not knowing a whole lot about death, you know, avoiding the topic and being terribly afraid of it.
Most people are.
Yeah, I believe that. And I realized, you know, here I'm watching this child whom I've grown to love die. And, you know, what do I do about that? So I was pretty shook up. And I ended up going to a two-day conference in San Francisco that was put on by Stephen Levine on death and dying. And at that conference, there was lots of talk about near-death experiences, trying to demystify death, trying to help people understand, you know, what the process is, how do you talk about it. And somewhere in the middle of the conference on the second day, Stephen looked over out at the whole group of us, and there were people sitting in chairs, and there were people who were actively dying, who were too ill to sit up in chairs, who were lying on cots very close to him. And Stephen looked at one of the men and he said, "Well, John, you're about as close to death as anybody I know. Would you like to share with the group what your experience is?" And I just practically fell off my chair because, you know, you don't talk about death, period. And you certainly don't talk about death with somebody who's dying.
What did he say?
John said, "I will try." And his voice was very quavery. I can remember this so well. And he talked about, you know, just the reality for him, his fears, his hopes, his only fear was that, I mean, he wanted to die a good death. He didn't want to shrink away from it. He wanted to be present for it. And he wanted to be able to reach out to the people to be present for the people who were reaching out to him and gathering round, and to, you know, to not move away from them in fear. And that was John's definition of a good death. And he apologized for his quavering voice, and he kept talking. And it was one of the most beautiful moments I have ever experienced.
Well, Laura, when you say John says reach out to the people who are there and reaching out to him.
Yeah.
That's what I believe you try and instill in the families of the young sight impaired or blind students who you teach.
Yeah, I did learn a lot from that to apply in situations where, you know, they're a little less grave than somebody dying. But being present, I think, is it's just the biggest lesson of all of them. And I certainly haven't got there yet. I'm trying to stay conscious of how necessary it is to be there for people. And, you know, and to be open and honest with them and to listen openly. I look back to what I used to tell people when I was 21, 22 years old, before I had kids of my own and before I learned some of these things. And I cringe a little. You know, I did the best I could, but a lot of it was, yeah, I was trying to know things I didn't know. And or trying to have authority that I didn't deserve. And learning some of these things through the School of Hard Knocks, or being exposed to people like John, people like Stephen Levine, people like my student Michelle, it was, you know, changes happened finally. And changes continue to happen. And yeah, I do try to be there to listen to people. And sometimes it can't happen, but sometimes it can. Or to just sit, you know, to be up front and say, it seems to me that, you know, this is happening, or I'm really worried about you, what's going on? Just to put it on the table and then wait and see what happens. And sometimes nothing happens, and sometimes a whole lot happens.
I would think that of the students who you guide around, and I would like you to talk about that process.
Yeah.
Once you've been out with them a time or two or three, they'll start talking about their world as they perceive it, using their own language and their own experiences to describe it.
Well, some of them do and some of them don't. A lot of the students I work with are pretty multi-handicapped, so they're not real articulate. Some of the students are pretty articulate. And it's interesting, if a child was born blind, their perception of the world is really, really, really different than that of a person who is born with vision.
How would you describe that perceptual difference?
Well, I'll never know, really, because when, you know,
it's kind of like asking a person of the other gender,
what's it like to be, yeah, uh-huh. And I was born with vision, and I still have vision. And when I shut my eyes, I have visual images. I know, you know, the concept of, you know, what does the inside of a room look like? I know what a tree looks like. I know where up is. I know what a cloud is. These things that are just I know what happens when the wind blows. You know, I know what that's like visually. For a child that's never had vision, or who's, you know, who's had very poor vision, it's a completely different sensory experience to be out there in the world. And a kid like that, who is articulate, will be walking down the street, and the kid will say something like, I hear the end of the building. And that's not your basic conversation that you would have with a sighted kid. But I teach these kids to use their hearing in a completely different way. And that's what I had to learn to get through this program and get the degree that I've got and the credentials, to learn how do I use that hearing. It's echolocation. So when the echoes quit bouncing off the glass on the front of the Mendocino Book Company, all of a sudden the echoes don't come back. And that is hearing the end of the building. So conversations like that will happen, or maybe the kid will be talking about, ooh, that, you know, the gravel's really crunchy under my feet, or the sidewalk's really hard, or textural kinds of things. Those kids don't talk about visual images. They talk about sensory experiences.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Laura Fogg, the author of Traveling Blind, Life Lessons from Unlikely Teachers. I'm Barry Vogel, and we're here in the studios of Radio Curious. Laura, as well as hearing the end of the building, are there spatial relationships that they have, like muscle memory? I know that if I put something down and can't find it, I'll close my eyes and move my right hand around, and I can often lead myself to it.
I teach kids how to search. We use that word a whole lot. You can use like small circles in front of you and use an ever-widening search pattern to find something that you've lost. People do develop muscle memory. I can teach my kids to stand out in space on a, you know, like in a room and make an accurate quarter turn. And something like that's really important. If you come to the end of the block and you want to turn left and go up Perkins, you want to make sure you're heading up Perkins at a 90-degree angle from School Street so you don't veer out into the street. So it is important to have that muscle memory to be able to make accurate turns. It's important if you've got a spoonful of food to know how to put it into your mouth, you know, instead of hitting your ear with it or something.
The 90-degree turn.
Yeah.
Is that learned by repetition, or is there something more that you share with your student when you teach it?
It's repetition up, you know, to some extent, but there's also a whole lot of other tricks. And you can teach people to listen to my voice. I'm right in front of you. Turn so that my voice is coming in your left ear. That's an accurate quarter turn. So we use other tricks, or the sun is on your face. Turn so the sun is shining on the right side of your head. Those are two examples of other things that I will teach a child to do.
You got into this profession in the early 70s.
Correct.
Graduating from Berkeley.
Right.
Moved to Mendocino County.
Yep.
And pretty much made a career, if not a legend for yourself, going from inland Mendocino County to the coast, to the
right.
North Coast,
yeah.
to North County inland and back, like you did today.
Yep.
How has this unfolded? You know, peel back the onion or the orange or the layers of the fruit of your life for the past 30-something years.
You know, I really think it's kind of a miracle that it happened, because I walked in cold back in 1971 to the superintendent's office. That was Lou Delsol. And I was so green, it was ridiculous. And they ushered me right into Lou's office, and he asked me, "Well, what could you do for us?" And I said, "Well, I'm a teacher of the visually impaired, and I had never really taught anybody." And I told him what I wanted to do and my ideas about teaching students, and he said, "Well, we happen to have 4 blind preschoolers, and it's, you know, you're like the answer to our prayers. Can you start on Tuesday?" And I said, "Yeah," and I was able to create a job for myself. There, nobody had done this before up here. Teachers of the visually impaired, especially mobility instructors, were pretty much they weren't that common in the school system. This was originally a rehab profession. So mobility instructors would work with adults who were blinded in World War II. But we were just starting to work with children. And nobody knew what I should be doing. They just said, "Go do it." So I got to create this job. And their students showed up out on the coast, and I spent about 10 years commuting out, you know, Fort Bragg and Point Arena and Mendocino and Elk and places like that. And then my coworker, who was Don Zeke, he was a teacher of the visually impaired doing mostly classroom stuff inland. And when he retired, they thought they were doing me a big favor to offer me his job so I wouldn't have to do so much commuting. And I said, "No, thank you," because I love driving around this county. And I'm also an artist. I do a lot of work with textiles and fabrics and make collage landscapes. And all this driving, every time I look out the window, there's another scene that I want to capture in my own artwork. So I don't get tired of it. And, you know, the ocean has moods, and the rivers have moods, and the seasons change, and you get to see wildlife. I saw a hawk swoop out of the sky right next to the car and pick a snake up off the road. And I've seen bobcats and a mountain lion, and I just don't get tired of that.
I can see why you wouldn't.
Yeah, it's a beautiful county. It's interesting that this job is now famous. When I go to conferences and I meet somebody for the first time, they invariably say something like, "Oh, you're the person who has that job. When are you retiring?"
I wanted to go back to Shana.
Yeah.
And the time when you met her and her mother in the grocery store.
Oh, that Yeah, that was just an amazing coincidence. This was after she'd been gone out of my life for about 10 years. I had not seen her. I had not had any communication with her family. It was sort of a tragic experience when she left. And when I saw, I just ran into her mother. I was in the co-op going out, and her mom was walking in. And there was, it was like that 10 years disappeared. So we, it was welcoming back a wonderful friend. And I got to connect with her again, and I have seen Shana again with her mom. We went down to San Francisco and met her. The place where she lives in Southern California made it possible for her. They flew her up to San Francisco. So we reforged that connection.
And now Shana is how old?
She's 24. Yeah. So, you know, I don't always, my students don't always move on to happily ever after kinds of lives. Some of them, you know, their lives get worse. Some of them end up in very difficult situations. Some of them I lose track of. And seeing Shana again after all that time, you know, since my experience with her ended very sadly, it was really, I was scared to do it because I was kind of afraid of what would happen when I saw her. But this was a child that I just loved dearly. She was a real kook. And she remembered me. She has multiple handicaps, and her speech is very strange. When I saw her in San Francisco, she said, "Laura Fogg is the lady who takes you to the bakery." And she was so right, because that's what we used to do here.
Well, Laura Fogg, this seems like a silly question, but can you tell us something important that you've learned lately?
Well, that's funny. That's a great segue from bakeries. What I've learned lately has nothing to do with blindness, but it has to do with localization of our food sources. And I've really gotten committed to buying and growing as much of my food, or growing as much as I can and buying the rest of it from at least California. I haven't gotten really perfect about buying it within 100 miles of home, but I'm trying, and I haven't bought a banana since the summertime, so it's a little bit of an effort.
Well, Laura Fogg, author of Traveling Blind, Life Lessons from Unlikely Teachers, can you tell us about an interesting book you've read lately?
I sure can. It's a crazy book. The title of it is My Year of Meats, M-E-A-T-S, and it's written by Ruth Osaki. And that is a really strange story about a Japanese-American woman who is facilitating a corporate executive in Japan who's wanting to do a program in Japan on meat consumption, which is just an anathema in Japan because they don't eat that much meat. So she's following a film crew around in the United States, going to various places where meat is grown and collecting recipes, which then get taken back to Japan for this television show. And there's a lot of direct translations of the communication in Japanese from her boss in Japan to her. So I just love the book.
Well, Laura Fogg, thanks for being with us on Radio Curious.
Well, thank you, Barry.
Laura Fogg worked as an orientation and mobility instructor for blind youth in Mendocino County, California, for over 35 years, beginning in 1971. Laura Fogg is the author of Traveling Blind, Life Lessons from Unlikely Teachers. This interview was recorded in December of 2008. The book she recommends is My Years of Meats by Ruth Osaki. There are over 500 archive editions of Radio Curious on our website, www.radiocurious.org, where they're free for you to stream, download, enjoy, and share. We appreciate your curiosity, ideas, comments, and questions. You may reach us by email. Our address is curious@radiocurious.org or snailmail 280 North Oak Street, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California 95482, or by phone 707-462-6541. You've been listening to Radio Curious. Christina Onnestad is our associate producer, and I'm host and producer, Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.